alive? I'm dumb. Are you stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive.
Tell you what, that new intro by Gard has grown on me. He's a bit of a genius, is Chris Gard, because I just said to him, you know, maybe I should get a new darker theme for Deepest Lore, make it sound a bit like the Undertaker's theme with a bit of synth in there, and he made that in like about half an hour. So yeah, it's kind of grown on me as time has gone on. Horace, welcome back to Deepest Lore, sir.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me back.
You know, over the past few days, I've become obsessed with this. Let me just show it to you. See if I can find it. Hold on. I can't stop watching it.
Up yours, woke moralists. We'll see who cancels who.
What the fuck is wrong with this guy?
Oh, the whole 30-second thing, he just kind of...
So cringeworthy. It reminds me of that Shia LaBeouf thing. Do you remember when he was doing his motivational video?
Oh, it's just amazing.
Up yours, woke moralists. We'll see who cancels who.
The caricature.
The only other thing that even comes close to that that made me laugh a lot was this.
College kids today really seem to hate Jews.
Oh, there's another one. All right, it's slightly different, but do you remember Rick Perry's campaign launch videos some years ago? They were like terribly cheesy, looking at the camera thing like that. Oh my God.
Well, just before we get going, Horace, where can people find you? Anything you'd like to kill, sir?
Substack, eternalhorace.substack.com. A few people signed up after the last one, so that was nice. And I'm putting out a new piece. I'm just editing it. It'll be a very long piece, this one. But it's taken me the last month to write.
Excellent. And today's Curtis Living Dead Part 1, kind of in your wheelhouse, because there's a bit of Cold War in there. There's quite a lot of World War II in there. And I know that you've done extensive work on both of those topics.
Spotted this one. This episode is one that I wanted to join you for.
Fantastic. Well, just before we get going, I'll remind people you've got just about 3-4 days left on my spring sale. Promo code MELLOW, 25% off. I'll just play my little trailer and then we'll make a start. Well, just before we get going, friends, if you like this channel, the best way to support me is to buy a course at the Academic Agency, but also you get something awesome in return, which is lifelong skills that you'll learn by doing the courses. There's currently a spring sale on, promo code MELLOW, 25% off all the courses, including the bundles, and I'll let you get on with the video. And just to clear up the rumours, I did not buy the electric humidor. I cannot justify spending a grand on that. You know, I bought a £20 big airtight Tupperware, and you can age cigars in that just as well. So, you know, save myself about a grand there. So I did not buy an electric humidor.
That could be the title of a novel, couldn't it? The plastic humidor could be.
Yeah, they call them in Tupperdors in the lingo. I mean, it's literally you just buy a big Tupperware that's airtight, and you stick a few of those Bediva pack, you know, Bevida packs in them, and it keeps them at a constant 65% rate. And because it's an airtight unit, moisture can't go in or out. You just have to air them every few months or so. Anyway, we are going to be continuing with Adam Curtis season. 7,800 views is the necessary benchmark for this to continue. We've easily been reaching that in a couple of days, and I think this one will do pretty well given the topic. So let's make a start. Like last time, Horace, if you want to say something, just say pause, or, you know, stop it and I'll pause it and you can make a comment. Well, We should probably say, Horace, before we start, I think that this is the first of Adam Curtis's signature canonical films. Would you agree with that? That there's an accepted kind of canon of Adam Curtis works, his kind of masterworks. And up until now, I have been looking at what most people would consider his early work, you know, Oceans Apart, Pandora's Box. Those are that's kind of early Curtis. And this is moving into, you know, if I was to make an analogy, this is his like hunky dory or something. This is like when he's starting to move into peak Curtis. And pretty much from here onwards, there is more well-known works all the way until hyper-normalization, I'd say. That's kind of peak Curtis. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, you sense these are his pieces entirely as well.
Yeah, I mean, all his signature kind of style is here now. You know, it was almost there in Pandora's Box. Remind me, there are still talking heads in this one, though, aren't there? There are still, like, bits of... So he still hasn't completely got rid of the talking heads, which he will do later on. But this is very, very Curtis.
Talking heads carry on through the Mayfair set and into the Power of Nightmares. There's definitely still talking heads in that.
Yeah, when does he get rid of those? The trap, maybe?
Yeah, at some point after.
okay. But yeah, this is typically when people think about Curtis, you know, the Living Dead will be one of the ones they think about. All right, let's make a start.
These are the German forests in which the last desperate battles of the Second World War were fought. Here, among the chaos and darkness, the Allies obliterated Nazism. Out of the senseless fragments of violent human experience, they forged a coherent memory of the war. It is the memory of the good war, which we have lived with for 50 years. But in the process, the victors buried those fragments that didn't fit. They were suppressed, even in the minds of thousands of men who fought among these trees.
The dream started with walking down a canal bank between trees, among trees. And suddenly I'm lying on my face and bullets are flying around me and mortar shells are falling.
Sorry to interrupt it again. I've just been reminded that everybody's been talking about this book that was published that a guy put out about 10 years ago, maybe even a bit longer. I can't remember what it's called now, The Unknown Warrior or something like that, or The Unknown Warriors, where this guy basically collected a ton of World War II veterans while they were still alive and asked them all sorts of questions. And asked them, you know, what they thought of the country, and just published them in a big book, you know, unedited. And a lot of people have been looking back at that book in the past week or so, pulling out quotes from there. Suffice to say, the men who, because, you know, people love to say, well, you know, your grandfather died for this freedom and all this, you know, at least we're not speaking German, etc. The men who actually fought in World War II, the actual veterans, hated what the country had become.
Hated what America had become, or Britain.
Britain had become. Multiculturalism, the death of, old-fashioned values, the permissive kind of sexuality, everything, basically. And it's all there. It's all in that book. I'm trying to remember what it's called. I think it's called The Unknown Warriors.
I seem to remember the Daily Mail or the Express reporting on it, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's by Nicholas Pringle, The Unknown Warriors. It came out about 10, 12 years ago. Looking at RAF aircrew, And I've just read a few. I haven't read it. I've just read a few excerpts and things like that. And it's a kind of one shot kill to anyone who tries to use that argument. You can just pull up the actual men who were, you know, they felt like they'd been betrayed and forgotten about. Basically. So,
but Churchill got a statue though. So,
well, of course, yeah.
Got two statues.
And he's got that guy who's constantly on various shows. You know, that big dude with the glasses. He's like a, I'm not sure he's from, Asian guy.
Race Heydrich, thank you.
Yeah. I mean, he is constantly defending Churchill.
And, he's not the worst person, actually. He's said a few decent things I agree with. But yeah, he's also an enforcer of Boomer truth in some ways.
And someone is dying and shouting on his mother, for his mother. And I woke up and I wrote it out. And as I wrote it, the details started coming back to me, and I realized this was no dream. I was just reconstructing the actual episode that happened, as it was. And that was the beginning of memory coming back.
Out of the carnage in Europe 50 years ago, the Allies selected certain memories. They used them to build the official version of the Good War.
Tell you what, I'm sorry to keep on interrupting this, but Curtis is pushing it with this. You know, this was 1995 he made this. I mean, this is some interesting territory he's getting into here.
I won't do spoilers or anything, but I think he's confused on this. His instincts lead him towards something that definitely should be talked about, but I don't think he handles it very well.
No, do you think this is one where rather than taking it 80% of the way there, it's more like 50%, something like that?
I suspect he's confused himself. He doesn't know what to do with what he's found.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
This film is about how that happened. It tells why certain memories had to be buried and forgotten because they contradicted the optimism of the big historical picture.
The fault of the big picture is that it omits evil. It's all good. We won the war, therefore we must have deserved to win it. Therefore we are wonderful people without fault, and so on. Right there you can read the history of modern Europe and the Allies' continued relation with it. A lot of the Cold War is based upon that. American behavior in Vietnam, which assumes that anybody who's opposed to communism must be wonderful, you see, and who's astonished when the people opposing communism proved to be as wicked as the communists. I'm thinking of Lieutenant Calley and people like that. Yes, it has a lot to do with post-war assumptions and post-war national behaviors, I would say, that great big picture, which so conveniently omits individual evil.
The story begins 6 years before the war, when the Nazis came to power in Germany. They promised to end the chaos the country had suffered since 1918. Hitler's right-hand man was Hermann Göring. Like many of the Nazis, Göring was convinced that a new Germany would arise only if it reawakened the glories of the past. In the forest north of Berlin, Göring began building a vast palace. Today, this is all that is left of Karin Hall.
Es war ein Haus von Göring, Karin Hall. Hier stand mal ein großes Haus, ein Schloss. Schade, dass das gesprengt ist geworden. Das war nicht sehenswert. Und jetzt alles eine Ruine.
Do you know, Horace, one of the things that I still don't really understand is how this government of Germany were able to achieve so much in such a short space of time. The narrative that we were always told at school was that they successfully brainwashed the German people and you know. But when you look at it, it's like, hold on a second, 5 years. They did all this in 5 years. How is it even possible? And I still don't really understand how they managed to do it all in just, like, if you take, you know, the time he actually came to power to the time the war started, everything's up and running by like 1937. I just don't get it.
Inflation, really. They just created like ridiculous but temporarily useful ways of spending. I think that's all it is. Like, sort of National Socialists of now give them a lot of credit for saving Germany from the Great Depression and stuff. I don't think they saved it. They just postponed the Great Depression. But I'm an Austrian in these matters. So
I mean, one of the things I've been thinking about recently is how the current American government work. And one of the things that I've kind of concluded is that current American empire works similarly to the way that they did it, which is basically like overriding economics with will and not worrying about, like, okay, yeah, we're in so many $1 trillion in debt, but so what? We can just make it happen because we've got a big army type thing.
Yeah, I said this to Gavin Bobey that I was talking to him last year, that Keynesianism was not embraced because everyone's read Keynes's general theory. Hardly anyone's read it, and of those who did, most would realize that it's nonsense. It's not Keynesianism itself that took over. It's just it was pretextual. It was just a way, just a way to justify spending more. And modern monetary theory is like a new dimension of that. You know, it's just ludicrous. There's no theory. It's just absurd. It's just spend what you want. It's just people telling you spend what you want, politician.
There's a very odd element, though, because if you actually read Paul Krugman, you know, famous
which you
Nobel
should.
Prize winning economist, right? He always and constantly talks about Germany in the 1930s, the economic miracle that happened in the 30s. And it's like, can I say this? Like, it's like the people who are in charge of America now have copied a lot of what the Germans did, both in economic theory, some of their legal theory. Like, if you look at the neocons, they're basically, you know, they act and behave and as if they've read and internalized Carl Schmitt. If you look at the way certain country in the Middle East is run, I mean, there's a lot of things that just seem to me to be straightforwardly just kind of, okay, we're not, I mean, they, if you read hard enough, they kind of admit it in various different places. But one of those strange things that when, you know, when like Jordan Peterson and Boomeritis, you know, call them fascists and things like that, you're the real Nazis and so on. There's a weird extent to which that is actually true. do you know what I mean? Like not everything, but certain bits of it, I think they've stolen. Anyway, that's
good. And we could go on about that for a while.
Yeah.
Yep.
Maybe off air.
Goering designed Karen Hall to evoke the power and splendour of Germany's distant past. The marble halls were lined with tapestries that displayed the images and symbols of the Teutonic Knights of old.
Und an der Wände waren auch Teppiche. Ich habe immer noch den in Erinnerung mit den den großen Teufel da drauf, mit dem Teufelbier da in der so, neuen Galerie.
In der Galerie.
Oh.
Nazis like Goering look back to ancient German history, to a time when knights rode through the forests of Northern Europe. The knights were powerful figures who had established political and intellectual supremacy. The Nazi aim was to conjure up this noble past, to mark the start of a new era.
They tried to give a new memory, a new history, a new past. There were big parades and big marches and big inszenierung and big things they made in the town to bring the history back. You would have got the belief that you are coming from a very important past and going to a very important future.
That guy looked like Race Heidel Manku.
He did a bit, didn't he?
Yeah. A young one.
I'm trying to think. Has any other documentary on this topic ever gone into this?
This is just the intro to me. The interesting bit comes in a little while. The most interesting, the most sort of contentious bit, the bit that really sees my attention.
But you know what I'm saying? Like, a lot of the times when you watch like a history of Hitler or something like that, I don't recall them going into, they were drawing on, the long history of medieval knights and, the kind of the mythos of Germany and so on. I don't recall any other documentaries going into this. So
yeah, the World at War does a little bit, like it shows some footage of, like medieval style pageantry and stuff in Nazi Germany. So yeah, it was mentioned, but that's a very long series. That's 24 parts, that's seriously long. I did, it's just one thing that keeps coming to my mind is that from, this is 95, you said, I think from about the same year, there's a BBC documentary on YouTube people might want to watch called, I think, Messengers from Moscow. It's surprisingly hard line. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder what was going on at the BBC at this time with BBC documentaries. I'm not really sure.
Well, this was kind of, I remember, I was around in 1995. This was peak kind of Schindler's List had just come out. And this was kind of peak Holocaust stuff, really. That was where it was everywhere. I don't know when that guy Finkelstein wrote the book, The Holocaust Industry.
That was a little later.
A little bit after that. But he's basically documenting this stretch. Like, it's the 90s where it was really front and center. I'm pretty sure I was made to watch Schindler's List at school at one point. Anyway, let's continue.
The whole Third Reich was a theater of memories that picked together from the past whatever was good and interesting for them, forgetting the rest, and they mixed them in a way never seen before. And there was a fascinating cocktail of a never-happened history.
Ihr Waldboden solle Schätze vergangener Jahrtausende bergen. Konnte ihre Mutter Erde eindringlicher zu ihr sprechen. Ein Wunder, welches sie und uns stolz macht, der Rasse anzugehören, die bereits vor tausenden von Jahren auf derart hoher Kulturstufe stand.
But the Nazis' project was far more than a simple reawakening of history. Their aim was to use the power of the past to transform those they governed into new and better people.
This is the former Congress building, Congress Hall. The Nazis planned it for their congresses, for the sub-organizations of the party rallies. It was planned for 50,000 to 60,000 people here to listen to the speeches of the big Nazi leaders. It's a mix between Babylonian, Egypt, medieval Greek, Roman architecture. The impression they were trying to give was of a very far away history, very mighty, very important, very big history.
The Nazis were deliberately manufacturing a mythical image of Germany's past in order to control its people. They believed that democracy and socialism had failed, because individuals, when left to themselves, became corrupt and barbarous. Only the nation had the power to control this evil. It could pull people together and transform their wickedness into a new, powerful force. The giant Nazi rallies were an expression of this ideal. Dwarfed by the symbols of the country's mighty past, individuals would lose themselves in the vast sea of the nation's soul.
Da hat man abend alle Lichter ausgelöscht und dann waren außen etwa 130 Scheinwerfer, die man im Krieg für die Flugzeuge gebraucht hat. Die hat man so aufgestellt, dass die ganz senkrecht nach oben gegangen sind. Und das war nun so, als wenn dieses ganze Stadion von einer Lichtwand eingehüllt wäre. Das hat also einen fantastischen Eindruck gemacht.
I mean, it worked, though, didn't it? This is the thing. It seems like that this aspect of making people lose themselves. I remember when I was reading Jonathan Haidt, he calls it activating the hive switch, right? I.e., you kind of transcend the individual and become part of something bigger than yourself. And apparently people feel a sense of euphoria or ecstasy. In the way he describes it in The Righteous Mind, he says some people experience it when they go to large sports events, for example, or like
big
a rave.
Yeah, raves with ecstasy and acid and stuff.
And they have, and it's part of being part of these huge crowds, and everybody's engaged in the same stuff. As a bit of an antisocial autist, I've always found the idea a bit horrifying, you know. But the closest I have personally come to experiencing that has been whenever I've been at like a rugby game back in Wales.
Thinking of rugby, the way that a rugby crowd can sing sometimes, it's like that is more than just individuals.
Well, if you're Welsh, the Welsh national anthem at a rugby match, I mean, it does, it always brings tears to my eyes.
The Welsh actually want it to sound nice as well, which is a difference from the English. But yeah, I've noticed that particularly with rugby, like the crowd itself seems to get in voice, you know, it seems to have its own voice, if only for a moment. And there's something stirring, like really stirring about it. And that's just a glimpse. I mean, this was these events they're describing here were crafted to maximize that.
The other times I reckon that it has been achieved in recent history, Michael Jackson concerts, Beatles concerts, when people were fainting, you know, those that's probably the same thing going on. Even recently, Taylor Swift seems to be doing something like this to young women, you know, who are, you know, when they kind of they actually just start weeping because they're overcome, you know. It sounds ridiculous, but there's something in that. And I've mentioned before, I think David Bowie, who I referenced at the start, I actually think he recognized this. And if you listen to the album Ziggy Stardust, when he's talking about the rock star reaching down, give me your hands because you're wonderful. It is at once the rock star, but also Hitler. Does that make sense?
He had his phase of saying that fascism could be good for Britain as well, didn't he, Bowie?
He did. He had a quote unquote far right phase as well. Did the salute? How much of that was for effect or just to be controversial?
I could imagine though that like the experience of being looked up to and treated as a, you know, some sort of superhuman by your fans, worshipped, adored. It can have that. I mean, looking down on the crowd behaving like that, you may begin to think, yeah, these people should just be controlled at least, you know.
I'm pretty sure Bowie's got a line somewhere where he says something like Hitler was the first rock and roll star or something like that. Because it's the same thing, if you think about it.
Yeah, and there's a particularly servile mentality in a lot of pop culture, right? From the fan to the star. I mean, it's one of the most disgusting things about, you know, pop culture, I think, can be brilliant. Like there's brilliant pop music and so on, but it's a disgusting example, but I was at a nightclub once and just the DJ, the way the women behaved after he finished his set was repulsive to look at. It was not repulsive, but like just demeaning, you know, just demeaning themselves. It was disgusting. And to be on a stage with thousands of women behaving like that, all the more so, and men behaving like that, embarrassing, you know. And you can see how people begin to see themselves as above the herd.
Yeah. But whatever those things are, these guys were activating it like to the nth degree, which could actually explain when they say, quote unquote, brainwash, they're probably talking about this, because they got people into this strange euphoric state where they're part of something. And I can imagine, if you weren't part of that, it would be fucking scary to be part of it, you know.
You ever notice the one here, it's very few people saying this about the Soviet Union. And there were some, you know, the occasional good speaker, like Trotsky was apparently a good orator and stuff, but you never hear people say that about Trotsky or anyone in the Soviet Union. They never allowed personality to matter as much as it did under Germany.
No, I think there was a period where Stalin started kind of tapping into nationalism and things, but their state was a lot more a lot more coercive, I think, you know. Like bullet to the back of the head if you don't listen type stuff.
Google but that. This bit of footage that's about that's just beginning here with all the typewriter women, this looks quite Soviet to me. This it comes from maybe like the left of the Nazi party, maybe.
By the end of the 1930s, Germany had become a coherent, directed society. It also represented a fundamental challenge to the ideas of democracy. Individual rights and reason no longer mattered. Instead, the nation was to be supreme. And one of the most fervent believers in this new faith was Hermann Göring.
He believed in the necessity to support the lasting life and domination of the German, as you might call it, nation state, the German body national. Göring said once, and that was years earlier, when he was Prime Minister of Prussia, he made a statement to the effect, I am the police. Every bullet that leaves the muzzle of a police weapon is my bullet. If that be murder, then I am a murderer.
I got a book here, Horace. I don't know if you've read it. It's called The House That Hitler Built by Stephen H. Roberts. It was written in the late 30s. By a chap, a journalist who went over and lived like in Germany for like a year and then wrote down a lot of observations and things. He's kind of surprised that basically he didn't meet anyone that wasn't up for what the government was doing. Now how much of it is propaganda, I don't know. But he goes into the personalities of the various high command, and he talks about the contrast between Goebbels and Göring. He says that Goebbels was kind of not very well liked on a personal level. He was kind of a bit cold and withdrawn, and even though he was the guy who had most of the ideas and the theory and so on, people didn't warm to him. But he describes Göring as the sort of guy who could crack a joke, hang out with the lads, have a beer, you know, just stand on the table and do a song. He had a kind of, he was the kind of soul of the party type of guy. And so he was used, according to this book, for morale, to keep up morale and to tap into, to kind of get beyond theory in a way, and just to click into those sorts of things, because people had loyalty to him in the same way that you'd have loyalty to a kind of, like we say, like a charismatic rugby cup captain, or you know, big personality down the pub or something. Have you heard that as well, or do you think that's propaganda?
In the World at War, I think people say like, Göring just had the air. It just seemed like a good fellow, even if you were on the left. He's just quite likable. I mean, not to the victims of the Gestapo and stuff, but it was immediately thought of as likable. And I remember Goebbels, I mean, did sort of loom larger as a figure during the war. I think he made, you know, some speeches here and they wheeled him out for propaganda, but I mean, it just doesn't look convincing. It's just this guy, it's a bit weird looking, he's got strange eyes, you know, it's not appealing. Göring was famous before in his own right as well, wasn't he? He was a barnstormer and stuff, and a flying ace.
Yeah.
That helps.
Yeah, he was a military guy, yeah.
It's a strange feeling. I cannot describe it and hardly declare it what it is, but this mix of history gave them a destiny for eternity. The last step to the promised land.
Early 1945, the war was drawing to an end. Everything that the Nazis had built in Germany had been destroyed. The past had been obliterated, physically and mentally, by what had become known as total war.
Sorry to keep on interrupting, but total war is one of the things I really hate about the modern world. And I mean, people could call me a romantic or whatever, but I would love to get back to a situation where war was, you know, two armies meeting in a field or something like that with strict boundaries, and you don't have to bomb cities and kill citizens and so on. I just hate the doctrine of total war. So
it's utterly, those who escalate and widen the bounds of war to include more and more civilians and so on are criminals. It's evil. Like the limiting of war is a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's inevitable once you get these kind of, like, as a consequence of mass democracy, basically, like whether it has to go this way. But I would love, like, you know, we've got all these things like the United Nations and international agreements and this concept of international law. I'd love it to be an international law that, you know, if you're going to have a war, just go and meet in a field or something. You know, don't bomb hospitals. But
anyway. Don't attack civilians. Don't target them. Yeah.
Diese Aufnahme habe ich gemacht. Das ist eine Frau, die von dem Fliegerangriff so mit den Nerven runter ist, dass sie zittert. Ich habe ihr die Verlustliste gezeigt, die in der Zeitung veröffentlicht war nach dem ersten Großangriff am 31. Mai 1942. Ich habe sie gebeten anzustreichen, welche von den Leuten ihre Angehörigen waren, beziehungsweise die sie gekannt hat.
The Allies now stood on the brink of victory in Europe. But the experience of total war was also destroying the confident certainties of their own past. The Americans had come into the war determined to put an end to European barbarism. But they found that the beliefs and assumptions they had brought with them were fading.
Pause
Europe
a second.
Was a much darker and stranger place.
Go on, yeah.
That is a rather favourable characterization of America's motives, I think. European barbarism by coming and blowing up loads of people.
He's taken like the rhetoric of Woodrow Wilson and FDR and people like that at their word there.
He is.
I think he's probably remembering some of those interviews he did for Oceans Apart, which is ostensibly, you know, what they wanted to do in their kind of moral vision type thing. And I do actually think there is a little bit of truth to it, that the Americans always saw themselves starting a new world apart from Europe, that has learned from Europe's mistakes. And, you know, we don't do things like that anymore type thing. We've seen how that's gone.
...than America.
And my crucial memory, and the memory that really starts all of my other memories about the war, is waking up in this pine forest, my first morning in the war. It was still dark, but just barely getting light. And as it got light, I was astonished to see within 3 or 4 feet of me several bodies, dead bodies, of German boys who'd been killed, I think, the day before by the unit we were relieving. These boys were just exactly like me, and they were killed. Their eyes were open, and their faces were as white as marble, greenish white. And at that moment, when I saw what I was involved in, actually for the first time, my training had never told me this, many of my adolescent illusions about reason and the governance of the world by reason and common sense and the idea of progress fell away all at once. And I realized in that one moment that I would never be again in that world of childhood innocence, where the world is run by reason and where events contain a certain amount of justice. I knew that I was now deeply enmeshed in a world of injustice and unreason, that I would have to figure out how to survive in that world or how to make sense of it later on.
As the war drew to an end, the challenge for the Allies was to make sense of what it had all been for. The soldiers who had lived through the battles had no idea what all the terrible experiences meant. We live, wrote one, on the desperate edge of now.
At the time of battle, combat, it's not coherent. you're always being surprised by the first shell that comes in, the machine gun, and it's fragments. It's accidental. Everything is accidental. I suppose that's what's the worst thing about combat, is that it's pure accident. It's pure accident that bullet 3 inches away wasn't through your head. So if you want to make sense of it later on, you could only do it on some higher level. You can't do it from the level of the private, the foot soldier, the tank man. You can't make sense of it.
Since you've gone, there's nothing left but sorrow. No joys now, our pleasures cannot find.
In May 1945, the Germans finally surrendered. The Americans, along with the Russians, were now the dominant powers. They were determined to put the surviving Nazi leaders on trial. They chose the city of Nuremberg, whose ruins their troops now occupied. The trials were to be more than just a legal process. They were to be a history lesson, an attempt by the Allies to piece together and explain what the war had been for. It will be the greatest history seminar ever in the world, announced one American prosecutor. But the Americans were to have a determined opponent, Hermann Göring. He had been brought to Nuremberg by his jailer, Colonel Andrus.
When my father first met him, his fingernails were bright red with fingernail polish, and in his baggage was a tremendous quantity of a drug. It was diagnosed as pericodine, which in itself is a fairly mild drug, but he was taking 20 or more a day.
Just pause a second.
When he was given his physical...
Go on.
I was just going to say, like, the way that one of the prosecutors had characterized the court, I can't remember what phrase he used just there, but like the very sort of we're going to make us, like, we're going to, you know, like, this is a display of justice for the world to sort of help commence the new era, right? So for anyone who's not aware, who's listening to this, one of the judges there was Andrei Vyshinsky, the same guy who was the prosecutor. Generally the lead prosecutor all through the 30s at Stalin's show trials. He was one of the judges at the Nuremberg trials.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that people don't know, I think, about the Nuremberg trials is that they were controversial at the time in America. There were a number of congressmen and senators who went on record. And this is where that book I mentioned, Witness to History, is pretty good at giving you all the kind of primary quotes and material. But a lot of people said it was basically had no actual principles of justice that either English or American legal tradition would recognize.
I think it's one of the most interesting things David Irving wrote about as well. He writes about how some people just had to be threatened and forced to participate in various ways. Some of them as witnesses, some of them in other roles, just outright sort of gangsterism to force people to go along with it at the time. I never knew any of that until just a couple of years ago.
It's become a relatively mainstream as well. Like there was a piece in the Atlantic a couple of years back, questioning whether Nuremberg was, you know, I mean, it still is at the basis of what we call boomer truth, but I mean, even in legal scholarship and things, there's a lot of question marks over what happened there, and whether this should be used as a basis for, you know, subsequent trials of that nature. You know,
it surely can't act as legal precedent for anything good. It's as far as like the proper workings of justice are concerned, it was impossible anyway because it's put together out of three or four victorious powers. So how could you combine their legal systems anyway? But if it sets a legal precedent for any sort of international law or criminal court or anything, that's terrible, because this was put together to condemn Nazism. It's not about justice. It's about specifically, it's like creating a victor's history. And that was what it was about.
Examination, the doctors discovered his toenails were also bright red.
Colonel Andrus put Göring on a strict regime to wean him of his drug addiction.
I also read, Horace, that of the 20,000 testimonies at Nuremberg from various different people on various different topics, roughly half of them are catalogued as unreliable in the, you know, in the records.
Makes sense. I mean, you know, a lot of them are going to come from the Soviets.
So, I mean, yeah, make of that what you will.
He quickly recovered and became the dominant figure amongst the 21 defendants. The trial began on November the 20th, 1945. The prosecution's aim was to show that the Nazis in the dock had conspired to wage war and to commit crimes against humanity. To prove this, they reconstructed the events of the past 15 years using documents, photographs, the emerging evidence from the concentration camps, and most dramatically, Nazi film.
We will show you their own film. You will see their own conduct and hear their own voices as these defendants reenact for you some of the events in the course of the conspiracy.
The Nazi plan was a film shown to the court. It lasted 6 hours and had been edited from millions of feet of captured Nazi footage. In particular, the triumph of the will, Leni Riefenstahl's record of the Nazi rallies in Nuremberg 8 years before. This was taken by Hollywood editors and recut with other footage to tell a new story. It showed that hidden behind the pomp and splendor of the 30s lay Hitler's conspiracy to wage war.
They took large parts of the Triumph of Will and other surviving Nazi footage and put it together. And the Nazi plan attempts to be a documentary history of the Third Reich. It's a good basis, and we know where the film came from. But it is, of course, a biased, Allied linking of German film.
Pause a
second. Yeah, go on.
So they were saying that just drawing on stuff like the Nuremberg Rally and the, obviously, the documentary film made about it, that they used that to make a case to show that the Nazis always intended to start this big war and stuff. You don't see that now. They don't, that's not cited as evidence whatsoever. Normally, most people who talk about it just avoid the evidence because it doesn't really clearly show that there was a plan to start the war, certainly not against Britain and France. Don't know how spicy we're getting, but, you know.
They always just, I mean, in my experience, having debated this numerous times with Tory boys and others, they just cry about Poland. That's basically what,
Or Czechoslovakia, right? Sometimes.
Yeah, and they say, oh, well, you know, Britain had to do it, otherwise he was going to take over all of Europe. You know, that's usually the line that comes out.
Yeah, it does just usually reduce down to just that assertion. It is just an assertion.
Yeah. I've got a book somewhere that goes through all of the myths, like one by one, like nine myths. I'm trying to remember what it's called now. This is a difficulty I've got in trying to write the book I'm writing at the moment, Boomer Truth Regime, because I don't want to write a revisionist history, but I do want to kind of highlight the fact that the myths that a lot of people believe in are basically edited together in the way that Curtis is talking about. So this is very relevant to me at the minute.
Just a quick one that everyone's stabbing their pocket, just if they come into that debate, is just during the Hitler Stalin pact, 1939 to 1941, the Soviets invaded Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Romania. And obviously that didn't trigger off any declarations of war against them. Well, it did by Germany, but that's a different story.
Yeah. I mean, they never deal with that, right? Because I mean, one of the things that I always like to point out is that it's like, well, you go to war to save Poland only to give it to the Russians. You know, I mean, you're basically like, you're saving Europe to give it to Stalin, basically. That is essentially what happens.
How that's not a huge conundrum for mainstream historians. Well, it just shows their power, really. It just shows that they are just defenders of power, because that is a huge glaring problem with the whole idea of it being a just war or a good war.
It shows the last just war, the war that had to be fought, that we were reluctant to fight, where the villains were clear and the heroes were clear. That's the memory.
What began in the courtroom at Nuremberg was the construction of the grand public memory of the Second World War. Out of the chaotic fragments of 5 years of warfare, the Allies forged a simple, powerful story. But the memories and experiences that didn't fit the story were quietly discarded and forgotten.
This official plot of the war, that it was a good war that proceeded from bad to good, or from defeat to success and victory, that's true. That's true. But it has almost nothing to do with the individual soldier's individual truth. They know better. They know sort of how much fun it was to direct artillery fire upon a hillside full of innocent German boys and blow them all up. It was fun. It involved a great deal of technical expertise. There's a way of doing it well, and there's a way of doing it badly, and so on. And you don't see the lads you're killing, so it's not as bad as it might be. But still, what you're doing is destroying human beings for the sake of a new post-war world.
Pause for a second. Just one thing that's occurred to me in recent years. Just, you know, when we were growing up, it was always a thing that people who'd fought in the war, in almost every case, they didn't want to talk about it at all, except to each other, right? Obviously, trauma and just the horror and the shattering of innocence and stuff must be a part of that. But I also wonder if when they came back, and this would apply in Britain, America, other countries, when they came home, did they find that everyone around them, all the civilians, were just talking nonsense because they'd all been propagandized the whole time? Obviously, the soldiers were propagandized as well. But as the guy's saying, you know, we experience the reality. It's just nothing like what you're told. I just wonder if like coming back and, you know, what you've experienced is a very morally mixed thing, right? You may feel like it was good overall that you were valorous and that, you know, you're not ashamed of what you did at all, but it's a complicated thing, a messy thing. You know, you saw murders, you saw crimes and stuff. I just wonder if they came back and they're just being told, oh, it's so wonderful or something, or just, oh, you saved the, you know, or whatever they were being, whatever the civilians were being told. It was probably maddening nonsense to a lot of the troops. I imagine, you know, very glad to be home, very glad to be getting laid again or whatever.
Yeah.
But also the propaganda was probably horrifying. May well have been horrifying to them when they came back.
You're probably right about that. Probably right.
I think the memory was built basically because the opponents were so evil that they make us look good.
The trial took place in the midst of a city the Americans had declared 90% dead. Few Germans ever came to the courtroom, and the Allied staff who worked there knew nothing of the world outside under the ruins.
In walking, you think you're alone, it's so quiet. All you've got to look at is rubble. You went through there and you felt alone, that nothing was there except stillness, and it was dead. And then suddenly you became aware of a head. Or saw a movement, and it was a head coming out from that rubble, just this head. It was alive and looking at you as you walked. And it gave you kind of a funny feeling that, oh, there are people there under the rubble.
To those living underneath the rubble, the version of history the Allies were constructing inside the courtroom was terrifying. What millions had once believed glorious was now being revealed as murderous. The Germans called it Zero Hour, the destruction of all belief in the past.
I was in the American sector of the city, and I came home. My father was dead. He was Nazi, a convinced Nazi, a very good creature, I guess. I loved him. But he was a Nazi, and he killed himself because he couldn't get over this, what was the past. So broken down, his hopes, and I came from school and told to my mother, to my brother, what I've learned about the concentration camps and the liquidation of the Jewish people and so on. And they said it's all lie. That's lie of the Americans. Don't believe that. Because they couldn't take this in their mind, that this is part of German history.
Pause a second.
The response to this cataclysm.
Go on, yeah.
I think this is where it starts to get really interesting, because we're talking now about the generational sort of critique that the younger generation level at the parents, yeah, the people who were of parent age during the Nazis. I think this is where it gets really interesting and sort of mangled on Adam Kurtz's part, because a few minutes ago he said, you know, this idea of simply a just war and a good war was an illusion. Your ears prick up, right? You're like, ah. But what he really veers into is actually a sort of 60s new left anti-fascist critique. I'm sort of spoiling what's coming. But and he's clearly sympathetic to that. I mean, I don't know to what extent he has to be or what, but I think this is where we see Curtis's sort of leftism come through, really.
Yeah, and I mean, considering this was 1985, maybe, and on the BBC, maybe we should expect it as well.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well, just the other thing that guy referenced as well, that he said, you know, we knew about the camps and so on and the liquidation, you know, he said we knew what happened and they just dismissed it all as lies. Well, what he may well be referring to there is, what was it called, the OSS? There's one in Britain, one in America, like a propaganda department of the intelligence services, I think, which made these films to guilt the people. And it was absolutely explicitly for that, you know, just to spread guilt and... sorrow, you know, and remorse, part of the conquest of the occupation of Germany. A lot of people, like I think Herbert Marcuse, were involved in this, and a lot of like film directors and stuff, you know, like they made sure everyone saw that image of the bodies being bulldozed and stuff, which is not from mass execution, that's from death from diseases, apparently. But anyway, I don't want to endanger your channel, but he's probably reporting on. I've seen in other documentaries, people were forced to watch these propaganda pieces, everybody, the whole population. And it's obviously going to work more on the kids.
Yeah. So you have the situation where the people who actually live through it deny it, but the people who had
been
that,
to the cinema.
Yeah. Had that education, let's just say, know it to be real. Interesting.
So the occupation ideology starts to clash with lived experience, you could say.
Was a wholesale wiping of memory by most of the German population. Millions of men and women who had been part of the Nazi system hid and denied their murderous past. A feature film made in 1946 tried to expose what was happening. It tells how a former army officer responsible for mass murder becomes a successful industrialist. One of his former soldiers returns to confront him.
Was wollen Sie denn von mir? Brauchen Sie Geld? Wollen Sie...
Ich fordere Rechenschaft, Herr Hauptmann Brückner.
Rechenschaft? Wofür Rechenschaft?
36 Männer, 54 Frauen, 31 Kinder, Munitionsverbrauch 347 Schuss.
Ja, was denn, um Gottes Willen? Da war doch Krieg. Da waren doch ganz andere Verhältnisse. Was habe ich denn heute damit zu tun? Jetzt ist doch Frieden. Wir haben doch Weihnachten. Friedensweihnachten. Mensch! Um Himmels Willen! Meine Frau! Die Kinder! Was haben denn meine Kinder damit zu tun? Halt!
But the film was a lone voice. Throughout Germany, the past was being buried and forgotten by millions of men and women. The Germans emerged from the ruins with their history rewritten. Meanwhile, in the courtroom, the Allies too carried on reconstructing Germany's past. They lived in a strange world. Each day, they listened to the careful cataloguing of Nazi atrocities, while in the dock, Rudolf Hess read Grimm's fairy tales. And every night, the Americans held parties in the...
Is he literally reading Grimm's fairy tales there?
Chad.
Is that true?
No idea.
Ballroom of the Grand Hotel.
Basically, it was a bachelor's dream, you might say. There were lots of romances. I got myself into trouble in no time. We had a lieutenant, a female lieutenant. Her name was Nancy Robinson. And she was beautiful. And she used to bring the mail, you know, to our desks and so on. And I had my eye on Nancy almost from the first day. And I shared an office for a while with a gentleman by the name of Robinson who didn't look anything like her. And she came in one day. She pranced in and pranced out. And I couldn't resist the comment. And I said what I'd like to do someday, you know, having the chance. And Mr. Robinson looked up and said, you know, Nancy's my sister. So there are things that happen that are not programmed. I don't think he ever spoke to me again. We shared the office. We continued to share it. And Nancy committed suicide later. I don't know what happened.
Oh, it was all American jazz. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a German twist, if you want to call it.
And you remember the singer? She used to sing, please, Mr. Truman, why can't we go home? We have conquered Berlin, and we have conquered Rome. We have defeated a master race, so why can't we get shipping space?
How did you remember that?
Ha, ha, ha. Pause a second.
Yeah, go on.
So, yeah, as if they hadn't suffered enough.
Yeah.
1945 arrives. You can only get like 1500 calories a day, and now you've got jazz being imposed on you as well.
Yes. I've talked about this before in when I've generally been defending people like Evola and the car manufacturer have got these various diatribes against jazz as a particularly pernicious form of Americanism, and the imposition of jazz in Germany in this period of occupation. It's one of the first things they did is that they made Germans watch American jazz acts, often jazz acts of color, you might say. They just kind of really imposed jazz on people.
I mean, what story does that tell? I mean, that means jazz comes from the top, you know, like.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a
regime music.
There's an essay by Evola on jazz, and there's an essay by, well, it's in the collection by Henry Ford, let's say.
Yeah, you did a video on it. Yeah, some years
ago. And for some reason, this is one of those things where people who are into jazz kind of leapt to its defense. And I'm like, well, it was always a top down thing. Because it's explained in that essay from the early 20s that the audiences didn't take to it, but they literally just didn't take no for an answer. Because they had monopoly publishing contracts, right. they basically locked out other forms, and you know, they booked out the theater space, because in those days you had to go to the theater to see acts and things, and they just made sure it was jazz act as opposed to European high culture. So I don't know, let's say Carnegie Hall or somewhere like that, you know, it used to be that you'd go there and you'd watch, you know, somebody doing an opera, or, you know, it'd be European high culture, a classical concert, something like this, but they were putting like jazz act in those spaces. Very often it would be a black jazz singer singing songs penned by, you know, people from New York. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Your eyes are blue, your kisses too. I never knew what they could do. I can't believe that you're in love with me.
But there was one German.
Hey, Göring being forced to listen to jazz.
He's like, make it stop, fucking hell. What you said a minute ago, I bet the ADL were involved as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of strange, because the jazz was also used as the spearhead to push, and, you know, the Evola take on it was that American culture was already what he called negrified, right? They'd already internalized it, okay? Mm. And but jazz was one of the vehicles through which this through which this was done. Because, of course, then if you capture the high society, you've got all of these people who would have been going to watch, I don't know, a Mozart concert or something. Instead, now they're watching some, you know, some jazz act with a, you know, with a black singer. Well, then, of course, it became, well, you couldn't really say anything about it because that would be frowned upon because now you're a racist and all this sort of stuff. So you can see how it, you can see how it's a, like a little Trojan horse that they used. So,
well, you know what else as well? There's a jazz album. It's like John Coltrane or Miles Davis or one of the big ones. It's called Birth of the Cool, the album. I think it's a, it might just be a recording of a live performance, but it's just called Birth of the Cool, right? Obviously, we the word cool means higher status in the sort of imagined hierarchy of what you're supposed to like, right? What you're supposed to dress like or listen to or whatever. They're actually claiming the birth of the cool happening on that at that night in some shit club in 1947 or whatever.
I've got another book here. It's called Hole in Our Soul by somebody called Martha something. Where literally the chapters on jazz say the exact same thing as Evola and Ford, right? The exact same thing, only, and that is a good thing.
Yeah, right.
And I come across that so often where it's just word for word, pretty much the same thing, only celebrating it rather than saying this is bad, you know? So, and in a way, I always respect that more than the kind of centre-right weasel, you know, like the Churchill defender, who tried to rewrite history and take these bits out, or try to, like, you know, or try to deny that this person or that person wasn't racist or something like that, or they try to whitewash history. In a way, I actually appreciate the leftist who just says, yeah, this was a kind of form of, you know, there was an ethnic component here, and this was a way of sticking it to white Americans, you know?
I respect them more than the centre-right weasel, and everyone in the world more than the centre-right weasel. So,
yeah, exactly.
Literally at the bottom.
The past should not be wiped. He wanted to defend it publicly. Hermann Göring was about to be cross-examined by the chief American prosecutor, Robert Jackson.
The cross-examination of Göring went wrong because Justice Jackson got a very good start. He asked Göring whether or not it wasn't true that in order to rule Germany, the Nazis had to do this, that, and the other thing, and Göring said, yes, those things were necessary. We were conducting revolution. So then Justice Jackson started to press it and asking these kinds of questions. Göring would make very long and circuitous answers.
Aber einmal, ich erinnere mich daran noch,
and Jackson became angry with him.
Let's omit the, let's omit that. I haven't asked for that. If you just answer my questions, we'll save a great deal of time, and your counsel will be permitted to bring out any explanations you want to make. You did prohibit all court review and considered it necessary to prohibit court review of the causes for taking people into what you call protective custody. That is right, isn't it?
Das habe ich ganz klar beantwortet, aber ich bitte, dass diese Ausführungen, die Sie eben gehörten, zu der Beantwortung mit.
And your counsel will see to that.
Jackson didn't reach Göring. Nobody could reach Göring. In other words, Göring, as a condottiere type, as I've mentioned, did not know the difference between good and bad and right and wrong. That didn't mean anything to him. So to confront him with crimes that he had been responsible for, but that he felt he had to commit these acts because they were necessary to safeguard the life and the future of the body national, was pointless.
Well, if you wanted certain people killed, you had to have some organization that would kill them, didn't you?
Again and again, Jackson accused Göring of corruptly using his power to commit crimes. Each time, Göring responded that such actions might be crimes in a democratic state, but that in Germany, democracy had failed. Eliminating the political opposition was necessary to fulfill a higher principle, that of the nation. And
I must say, in the interests of YouTube people watching, obviously we actually condemn these crimes, don't we, Gorus? We condemn the crimes of the of Hermann Göring, and so does all the chat.
Sure.
It had worked, Göring insisted. It had brought order and prosperity to Germany.
In Germany. Unter den damaligen Umständen war sie nach meiner Auffassung die einzig mögliche Form und sie hat auch gezeigt, dass Deutschland aus seinem tiefen Elend der Verarmung und Arbeitslosigkeit in kurzer Zeit zu einer verhältnismäßigen Blüte wieder gekommen war.
Finally, Jackson lost his temper and appealed to the judges to control Göring.
The difficulty is that the tribunal loses control of these proceedings. Outside of this courtroom is a great social question of the revival of Nazism. And that one of the purposes here of the defendant Göring, I think he'd be the first to admit, is to revive and perpetuate.
What frightened Jackson was the link between the political ideas that Göring was explaining to the court and the terrible crimes the Nazis had committed. The horrors revealed at the trial were so overwhelming that those who had committed them began to be seen as alien and utterly other. And so the trial became a morality play, a battle against evil, with Göring's role that of the villain. The ideas that had led millions of ordinary human beings to support and participate in such barbarism were too dangerous to discuss. They had to be locked away and hidden.
What was missing at Nuremberg was the indictment of the ideology of the Thousand Year Reich. Everybody nowadays knows what the war was being fought for, but nobody really has paid much attention to what the Germans thought the war was fought for in their sometimes, how shall I call it, a very twisted mentality that was spread by Hitler and his people. The body national, a form of nationalism where the entire nation was considered one body that had to be assured of its security and life. In the name of this mentality, most of these crimes were committed.
Pause for a
terrible
second.
Execution.
Yeah, go on.
It just says, like, I mean, Curtis said just a second ago that they were sort of trying to, but failing at Nuremberg to try and to nail the Nazi ideology itself, or to nail down this was the reason for the war and it was an evil reason. You know, like, you can see why that. I mean, the actual events of how these things unfolded were so much more haphazard than that. There is not one book that clearly states the Nazi ideology. And it wasn't especially ideological as a movement as such, right? It's a movement that, when I was taught politics at sort of sixth form college level, the first thing they said was, like, of all the ideologies, this is the one that's hardest to describe. You can describe the events, but Nazi ideology is almost just a vapor. Really, the ideology was, we want our nation to survive. Like, in Mein Kampf, Hitler just talks all about the death, like, our nation is dying. You know, it's a sense of crisis. It's just a reaction against that. And that's about as close as you get to a sort of an ideology. It's just, we must revive our nation. That's really what it comes down to.
I kind of pursuing this vexed historical question, I once read, you can actually find it on archive.org, which is the copy I read. There's a Hitler Youth manual from 1938, because I wanted, I was very skeptical of the claim that is often made that they would do it, you know, that they did what they did because they believed that the people they were killing were inferior. Mm. Okay. And I was skeptical of that. And it was actually Murray Rothbard who was the first person I read who kind of sowed the seed of doubt as to whether that is true, that they had this view of themselves as superior and they wanted to kind of eliminate quote unquote inferior races. And I thought, well, if anywhere is going to say it, it'll be in the Hitler Youth manual, because it was written for kids, so, you know, it could be relatively easy to understand. And it doesn't say that. In fact, if you read the Hitler Youth manual, it is literally pages upon pages of almost autistic anthropology categorizing the different types of people who make up the Germanics, right? So like Slavs, or I'm trying to remember who, not Slavs, semi-Slavs, semi-Slavs they call them, or is that a chest defense? I think it's both. But there are like six different subcategories, what their traits are, where they come from, what roles they'd be good at, you know, what Great Germany would look like, where the German diaspora is. It's really bloody boring, to be honest. But it's like it doesn't really go into here's what we believe, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's more a kind of, I mean, honestly, it's autistic. that is the descriptor I would use for what is the contents of that manual.
Reading Mein Kampf, he does sort of imply racial superiority on the part of Germanic people, not just Germans, but including the English as well. He just gives a plain reason, just says, look at all sort of civilizational and technological achievements. They're all ours, almost all. He just says, well, that just speaks for itself. The world must have our civilization sort of at the heart of it. You can't do it without us. Well, you can have barbarism, or you must have us. It's pretty straightforward. And, you know, that's not much different from people who say that now about Britain, you know, about the British Empire, that it was generally a good force. He's just saying Germany sort of gives leadership to the world in culture and stuff, you know, whether he's right or wrong. This is what he believed. It's not that extreme. It's roughly what people say of the British Empire now. You know, we've brought a lot of good to the world.
Shown on film at the trial became a central image in the public memory of the Second World War. But they were seen and understood as the acts of monsters, not of human beings. What was buried at Nuremberg was any idea of examining why Nazism had happened in the first place, what the social and political forces were that had led ordinary people to such savagery.
That's when I thought they deserved whatever punishment they got. They had to be cold and cruel and unfeeling. What kind of people are these? They're not like the human beings I've known all my life.
After Göring's cross-examination, the judges ruled that no defendant would be allowed to go over ground already covered by Göring. There must be no further explanation of Nazi policies.
The day of the sentencing, I was in the courthouse, and the defendants assembled outside of the courtroom, and the roll was called, and I was asked to call the roll, so I called the roll. It was a strange feeling, you know, and I said, Göring, jawohl, you know, and they stepped to attention. Keitel, jawohl, he was a field marshal, and so on, and that was it. That was my entire part in the thing.
Defendant Hermann Wilhelm Göring, the International Military Tribunal sentences you to death by hanging. Defendant Rudolf Hess, on the counts of the indictment on which you have been convicted, the tribunal sentences you to imprisonment for life.
Göring had prepared for his suicide more than a year in advance, before he was captured. He had taken three of these suicide capsule containers. I have the one Göring finally killed himself with. They were 1 cc ampylocyanide, kept in this cut-off rifle cartridge case for protection. These were mass-produced at one of the concentration camps. And he was lying on his bunk and just decided the time had come, so he moved the ampulour between his teeth and bit it. Everybody converged on him, and he was dead.
Oh.
They were cremated in the ovens of Dachau, which was something that he planned very carefully, because they are the ones that ordered other people to be cremated in those. And then the ashes were deployed into an unidentified river.
My father wanted the good to be glorified and honored, but not the evil. And so he made great efforts to prevent any item that these criminals, particularly the ones that were condemned, anything that would remind anybody of them to be removed and destroyed forever and wiped from the memory of the world, hopefully, what they, the evil that they had been a part of.
Well, here is a pair of Hermann Göring's underwear left behind in the laundry when his body was taken away to be burned. Beautifully made, monogrammed, finest materials, and his socks, again, handsomely made, wonderful material, and here was this little pile of laundry. That was the only remaining souvenir.
When the trial was over, and the defendants that were sentenced to death were executed, and Göring had committed suicide, he beat them to it in a way, the show was over. With them went the idea of the Body National, which is now looked at as a phantom.
Hitler, out. Swastikas, gone. Nazi propaganda, off the air. Concentration camps, empty. You'll see ruins. You'll see flowers. You'll see some mighty pretty scenery. Don't let it fool you. You are in enemy country. You are up against something more than tourist scenery. You are up against German history. It isn't good.
Following the trial, the Allies embarked on a gigantic act of exorcism. They destroyed all trace, not just of the Nazi past, but of Germany's military history.
Were they burning books for us? They were burning books, weren't they?
On the, I think it's on the Wikipedia page about like denazification or something. It quite frankly admits that, like, yeah, the SA or like Nazi students or something in the early 30s were burned a pile of books. You know, a few universities symbolically didn't try to eradicate those books from all libraries or anything. Well, maybe over time, but after the war, loads of books were like banned, you know, by law, as in it's illegal to hold any copy of this book. Thousands of books. It's like, you know, not book burning, it's like book eradication.
Yeah, I even heard that they had the you know, the printing machines, they had the actual original kind of print sets melted down,
right?
So those books were literally eradicated,
salting the earth, you know. Yeah. And I would just say, like, that bit of propaganda video just then, I was like, you know, what you're up against is German history. It isn't good. It's like, why do the troops need to be told, like, that they're being too friendly? Or, you know, what? Like, what was happening? Were troops beginning to meet German people and realizing, oh, wait a second. These are just like the people who live in Pittsburgh, you know, like, right? This is not what I've been told. You have to actually, I mean, it's like, I recommend everybody be aware of the anger campaign in Britain that was started in 1940 or 41, started by Churchill's idea, I think, and implemented by Robert van Sitter, who had been head of the Foreign Office and was extremely anti-German before Hitler, as well as during Hitler. Mm-hmm. The anger campaign was literally just, we need to get people to hate Germans, otherwise they're not going to let us bomb the cities. It's as savage as that. And it's like that. It's like, you know, you're actually having to teach the troops to despise the country they're in.
Well, one of the interesting things is that the Soviets didn't really go as far as this in the East. And this is something that people talk about quite a bit, which is that even though East Germany had its own problems being under communism and so on and so forth, they didn't do this massive psychological warfare that we're watching here. So, and that has its legacy today, because if you have a look at support, for example, for the AfD, it's all in East Germany.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have this, you know, I mean, possibly historically unprecedented mass psychological warfare campaign. I say unprecedented. I feel like it's been rolled out to an export and kind of imported back to America and to Britain. I feel like Germany was the test case, and then once they had done, you know, done their job in Germany, a similar process started in America itself and here. Because if you have a look at the messaging on our history and our you know, a sense of national pride and so on.
Yeah,
it's all the same, and in America as well. You know, bound to pulling down the statues and desecrating the museums and all the rest of it.
I made a similar point in a video I made a few years ago. I've seen Joel Davis a similar point on Twitter. I've seen Eric Stryker say it recently on his show that the war has not ended, and that's why they call you Nazis. Because they're still waging a war against any white people who stand up for white people, you know.
Well, European culture writ large, or the idea of European civilization as a kind of body politic, or as a kind of organic whole, you know, which is essentially what that guy said, that translator said. You know, that is some. I mean, if you read some of the Frankfurt guys, that is what they, you know, had in their sights when they defined the authoritarian personality type and all the rest of it. I have a video called "What Yuri Bezmenov Didn't Tell You." It's kind of a clickbaity title, but that is all about this idea as well, that denazification kind of expanded in scope to include basically everyone. I mean, even in countries that were nominally neutral in World War II and weren't even part of the war, even they get it. So
yeah, coming up shortly is when Curtis begins to say that it. I agree with you, but Curtis begins now to say that. It didn't go. It was wrongly stopped at a certain point because of the Cold War. Basically, we'll come on to it.
All right.
The giant statues that lined the Tiergarten in Berlin were removed to a compound to be dynamited. But the Germans organized a secret operation to rescue them. They remained hidden until 2 years ago.
Sie wurden dann bei Schloss Bellevue im Garten vergraben.
Someone in the chat is saying the Soviets were just as zealous, if not 10 times more, in their reformation of Germany. What is this historical illiteracy? Well, in the accounts I've read and all the material I've looked at on this, the Russians were more kind of repressive in the sense that, you know, they could beat you up or put you in jail or whatever, but they didn't go to these kind of extreme kind of mental mythological reprogramming lengths. That's what I have read and heard. I mean, I don't know if you've.
Well, yeah, I presume you're not saying that they were soft on them. It's just they didn't have the same process. But like, I think most Nazis would have fled East Germany, surely. Like, so it wasn't the case. I mean, to the extent that there was any Nazism left in Germany, it was mostly in the Western occupation zones, where people felt that they would at least be allowed to live.
I mean,
there was a Nazi structure still to dismantle in the minds of the occupiers. Sort of.
You'd rather live in West Germany than East Germany for obvious reasons, right?
I mean, well, innocent civilians were treated like terribly in the East, let alone anyone who'd done the thing.
It's shit living under socialism or communism. But the point is that they didn't go to these kind of, like, it's almost like in West Germany, they completely try to reprogram the German mind.
And
in a way, they didn't do that in the East, to the point where now people who grew up and people who are from the East part of Germany still have a sense of kind of national history and nationhood and so on and so forth, conservatism, whereas that's been... my understanding is that a lot of people in West Germany, I remember hearing or reading once that men in West Germany sit when they go to the loo to have a wee, you know. There was some campaign that told them there was health benefits to sit down when you wee. I mean, this is a level of kind of cucking and humiliation that I don't think they did in the East.
I do agree with the commenter that obviously we shouldn't give the impression that anything was better under the Soviets. But under the Warsaw Pact, what you said about sort of nationality perhaps in some ways not being repressed as strongly, or national feeling. Under the Warsaw Pact, the countries, the other members, were encouraged to think of themselves, bullshit obviously, but to think of themselves as willingly allied, right? Obviously they were under Soviet domination, as Hungary and Czech Republic, Czechoslovakia discovered, but you were the illusion was supposed to hold that this was a happy alliance of separate states, right? Mm-hmm. So in that sense, some degree of national feeling could be allowed, albeit your loyalty must actually be to the regime.
Yeah.
Ein Nacht und Nebel, wie man
sagt. I mean, it could just be as simple as saying that the Americans or the Allies are simply more psychological and they're just better at propaganda, right?
I
remember reading Edward Bernays about like recreating somebody's dreams. So you don't try to sell them a product, you reprogram their actual dreams so that they actually believe they want this. And I feel like the socialists just weren't as sophisticated as that in their propaganda methods.
Reading loads of books, but I mean, Stalin's War by Sean McMeekin comes to mind, but there's loads of other examples as well. The anti-fascism of Roosevelt, especially, and Harry Hopkins, also Churchill, arguably exceeded that of Stalin or anyone else. I think Stalin largely, I mean, it probably changed when Barbarossa began, but Stalin probably saw Germany as, you know, the most troublesome of a set of bourgeois powers, right? You know, mm-hmm. we need to confront all of them. Britain's still, up till like 1940, even into 1941, Britain's still a threat. France is still a threat. Well, no, France isn't, sorry. Britain's still a threat. Britain still might turn against us. You know, our job is to make sure Britain and Germany don't make up. You know, that's Stalin's perspective. Whereas Roosevelt, Churchill, people like that, they treated Germany as this thing that just all the rules that apply to everything else don't apply. Just Germany's this special threat. No matter what it does, no matter what they say, no matter how much they're looking eastward or whatever, it's the most extreme threat. That carried through. I mean, people were so sort of admiring of Roosevelt and Churchill as individuals, and so like such followers of them, that filtered down, I think. Roosevelt especially, it's amazing how anti-fascist he was. It's incredible. It's his whole career as soon as he became president, was just obsessed with lining everyone up against Germany.
Yeah, there's... It is basically the ideology of the regime is anti-fascism.
Since at least 6 years before the war.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Yeah. In fact, there's a book called Anti-Fascism by Paul Gottfried, which talks somewhat about this, as are various other people. But if the regime has an ideology, it is anti-fascism. That is why Antifa, now proven by people in Ireland, by the way, but also said by me 4 or 5 years ago, are obviously foot soldiers of the state and quite sometimes just working hand in glove with the police or straight up state sponsored. Antifa are like the brown shirts for this regime because they've always been anti-fascist.
Absolutely.
Ich war nicht dabei, aber es muss eine geheime Aktion gewesen sein, so geheim, dass man später gar nicht mehr wusste, wo diese Skulpturen liegen.
We're getting criticism from the other side now, Horace, saying that we're overstating how bad life was in under communism.
I suggest people read that book, Hellstorm. That's about just sort of the first year or so of Eastern Europe and especially Germany experiencing the oncoming of Soviet domination. It's horror. I mean, obviously, it's a German sympathetic book, but it's based in fact, as far as I know. And life under the Soviets from the moment they took over was abominable. I will not countenance any sort of going soft on the Soviets here. Scum, utter scum. Yeah,
I mean, anyone I've known from anyone who's like lived or any part of their lives under Eastern communism absolutely hates it. There's that guy V. Who grew up in communist Romania, absolutely despises it. Poles that you come across, I mean, their hatred for the Russians is almost unlimited. because of how much they hated living under communism. So,
I mean, even as you can read from all different wings of politics, all different ethnic groups. I read Gulag by Anne Applebaum last year. Obviously, she puts her own slant on it, but it's, I mean, the sick. I don't know where to start. So let's move on.
For the Americans, these sculptures symbolize the old barbarism that had plagued Europe for centuries. That was now gone forever. The Good War had ushered in a new age in which such terrible things would never happen again, because evil had been banished from the world. Large parts of the European past had to be wiped and forgotten. A new world would be constructed, free from the bitter historical memories that had driven nations to war again and again. In the American project, the individual and democracy were more important than the nation. Underlying this was an optimistic belief that human beings were good.
We all had a hope that the world would have learned something from the horror of World War II, that people had learned perhaps to be more civilized in relations between one nation and another, that there wouldn't be a repeat of the invasions, the killings, where disputes could be settled without war.
Here is one of the many buildings in which tomorrow the General Assembly of the United Nations will be waging not war, but...
But this failed.
Peace. Entering will be representatives of all the nations dedicated to peace, large and small, meeting together in sovereign equality. These men and women...
We visualized a world which would be more rational and civilized, where nations would get along with one another, where people could live with each other in peace.
This is not the capital of some super state trying to rule the earth. It represents the mind and conscience of the world. It is the watchtower over tomorrow.
If individuals really could be freed from the threatening ghosts of their past, then a new, more civilized kind of human being would emerge. Citizens of a new age, free for the first time from the power of history.
Die Alliierten wollten dieses Stück Geschichte verdrängen, zerstören, annullieren, und darin liegt ja ein gewisser magischer Akt.
You know, it's ironic though, Horace, because I feel like no matter what happens, you know that image that he had of the swastika being blown up? It's like this regime that they've built now, it can never get away from it. It's always there. It's like the ultimate reference point, and everything comes back to it, and it defines itself against it again and again. So even if it's trying to forget it, it never can, because it's just like everything constantly has to relive it over and over again. And this is the thing ultimately I want to break. I want to try to get away from the paradigm where everything comes back to that. You know,
I know very well. I strongly agree.
Up in a new sky, and my whole horizon has reached a new high. Yesterday my heart sang a blue song, but today here at home a cheery new song. I dreamed a new dream.
The heroes of this new age were the veterans who had fought and won the war. But many of them had secret memories that conflicted with the official version of the Good War. Memories that gave a much more complex and frightening picture of what they had done.
Those memories, after a while, they control you, you know. They come to you. So what happened? You think about what happened. You think about the bad things that happened over there, because some of it is very bad. And then you got dreams, nightmares, you know. You hate people. You fly into a rage at the little sting, you know, the little... smallest thing, bang, you know, you lose your temper. You hate the world. You stay by your...
Shit, I'm like that and I haven't even been at war. Or
Hey, turn that off. Will you turn that thing off?
What's eating you now?
Yeah, what's eating you? That music, it stinks.
Oh, you don't like it, huh?
No, turn it off.
Now, wait a minute, pal. There's clearly a conflict between individual memory and the big story, as you might put it, which was constructed out of a number of actual and very useful events. One was the trials at Nuremberg, which established the version of the good war, which is certainly true. On the other hand, chipping away at that constantly is the secret version of the war, which is possessed by the actual combat veterans.
Did you ever want to forget anything? Did you ever want to cut away a piece of your memory or blot it out? You can't, you know, no matter how hard you try. You can change the scenery, but sooner or later you'll get a whiff of perfume where somebody will say a certain phrase or maybe hum something. Then you're licked again.
The problem is that the experience of the veterans is very largely depressing, pessimistic about human nature. It shows how awful human beings can be, and how indeed how they can be brought to enjoy murder and enjoy depriving other people of their limbs and their lives. Now that's very bad news for human nature, and it conflicts with the optimistic news which is conveyed by the official picture.
Can I just say, everything that guy has said in this documentary is so dark.
Yeah.
It's really dark.
Yeah.
Yes, go on. You remember it now.
Many thousands of veterans had wiped their memories. The US Army made a film record of the attempts to help them. It was kept hidden for over 40 years because it was considered bad for civilian morale.
All right, go on. You don't want any more. You want to forget it. But you're going to remember it because it's gone now. It's gone. You're back here now. You're away from Okinawa. You've forgotten it. But you remember who you are now. Who are you?
Men who cannot remember. Paralyzed men whose paralysis is dictated by the mind. However different the symptoms, these things they have in common. Unceasing fear and apprehension, a sense of impending disaster, a feeling of hopelessness and utter isolation.
Still, at least they're not speaking German.
Now, dark, so dark.
For dreaming and on the meadows below.
The middle class world, that's sort of the American dream, as they say, was not for you. You were an outsider. I couldn't have stood the idea of settling down in a nice family world. And I did try, and it didn't work. Then I had dreams, and those lasted for 40 years. Scenes of violence, death, disfigurement, horror, which I have always carried inside of me. And I feel that's the real possible world. That's the world to which things can be reduced very easily. And this has made it hard for me to function easily in society at times, because I always felt that I might be thrown back into that world. That's the real world. What the hell is this person talking to me like that? I'm going to take a rifle butt and smash his head in. I was always afraid of being reduced back to that. It was a world in which ideas don't count for anything. Sentiment doesn't count for anything. It's just dust back down to the brutality of conflict. And that big secret world which you have to sort of bury.
What I like about these soldiers and their... what they're saying, because it's revealing something that we've talked about. This is something that Mike from Imperium Press has talked about a number of times. It's like, well, the liberals never actually won any debates or anything. All they did was like killed a lot of people through brutal violence and won a war. They didn't actually win any debates or intellectual ideas or anything. And so what this guy is saying is basically true. Oh, you know, the kind of bedrock of our current order.
Like someone pointed out, I was watching like Jimmy Dore or something. They pointed out that all that Israel's been saying over the last 6 months to justify a massive amount of killing in Gaza is all their sort of people arguing for them and saying, well, what else are they supposed to do? What else could they do? And that's just the same justification that's used in retrospect for Second World War. It's like, what would you do? Let Hitler take over. Do you know what I mean? Whereas, you know, these guys are just telling you actually what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, in the Israeli case, it's interesting because occasionally they have lent on ideas like Dresden and things like that
yeah.
to justify what they're doing.
It's like, that's not justification. Like you, but they've observed that that works on us, you know, that it has this hallowed effect, you know, of, well, terrible things can be justified. You know, that is the depth of the liberal argument that you refer to there.
Yeah, I increasingly have come to think, when you say it kind of works on us, I feel like it's only really two generations who had it. You know, it's clearly this generation, the generation who actually lived through the war, didn't like. I mean, I've been told by older people that in Britain in the 50s, nobody talked about the war at all, right? But later on in the 60s and the 70s, there was a lot of World War II stuff for the next generation on, taught, you know, the kids taught in school rather than the people who actually lived through it. So if you think about it, it's the boomers who had it their whole lives and the Gen Xers. And then, I mean, well, I was born in 82 and, you know, I'm in my 40s, it's already falling apart. And, you know, lots of people are already starting to think, well, you know, the reverence is gone and it's starting to be more openly like aspects of this narrative have been picked apart a bit more. And I don't think it has that haloed effect anymore, you know. You know, when I think of Dresden, I just think it's barbaric, you know. And I think that's the response of a lot of people now. So really, we're talking about two generations of people, boomers and Gen X.
Yeah.
I suppose I buried that and buried a lot of memories with it. I wanted to get that down and out of it. It came back in dreams.
By the late 50s, Germany had become one of the most prosperous countries in Europe. She was also now America's ally in the Cold War. American attempts to denazify those who had run the country had been quietly dropped. Good bureaucrats and businessmen were needed to build a strong state against the Soviet threat.
I will say, in the interest of fairness to Curtis, on this point, I have actually read a number of accounts that said that there was an active effort made by not only the Allies, but also the Jewish community to actually draw a line under it when it, like, i.e., just let it be the leadership and these few little aspects. And there was actually a scaling back of limiting the scope of what denazification touched and what it didn't touch around this time. So this is not the first time I'm hearing this. How true that is, I don't know, but I have read it before. Yeah.
Well, this is all right. So we've arrived. The bit that I said earlier is the really interesting bit coming. This is where we arrive at it now. This sort of generational conflict, right? Denazification, I think, was cut off at a certain, like, early 50s, maybe pretty fairly soon into it, and it was quite specifically because they were struggling to recruit people for leadership positions. Because if you excluded everyone who'd been in the Nazi Party or whatever, it was just excluding too many people, and it was also intelligence agents who, obviously, from the late on in the war and for some time after, had been brought to America mostly, or assisted by the CIA, and also people like Wernher von Braun, obviously. And it was also military officers specifically. It was, we need some of the people who were, you know, like, for instance, a lot of people who were senior officers in the Wehrmacht joined the Nazi Party because they needed to, because it was kind of important for your status. And excluding all those was just irrational. So they could make that example in the first place, and then they could say, actually, if we widen this out, we can strengthen ourselves, we can play a bigger part in NATO, right? We can play a bigger part in the Western Alliance and in the burgeoning sort of coal and steel community that's going to lead to Europe, as they say. You also had Winston Churchill from about 46 saying Germany must be embraced into the West, because Churchill began to promote the idea of European unity, right? Germany had to be part of that. He specified that. He pissed loads of people off by saying it, but he stuck with it. So from all directions, it was like denazification. Let's have, yeah, they had it hardcore, very, very strict for a few years. And then it was just stopped pretty much. I had no idea that like Jewish organizations approved of that. That's surprising. But it also fits with something I know from before the war, when German Jewish organizations did not respond the same as those from outside Germany to the rise of Hitler. They wanted to, they wanted peace with Hitler.
I mean, this is something I've noticed as well, though, which is that there's quite a lot of, I mean, there's, because I've got lots of books here. I mentioned that one by Finkelstein. That there's a number of others that, that go over this little period of history in some detail. And the impression I get is that the in that period, in the 50s and the 60s, they were a lot more pragmatic, and a lot more willing to compromise and play a smarter long game and things like that. You don't get this kind of this kind of binary black and white thing that we've seen in recent years.
Yeah, everything's burned away except the ideology. That's the only thing still going, but and that consumes everything.
It was in everyone's interest to forget the past.
Jetzt geht's ja wieder aufwärts mit uns. Und man hat es Schritt für Schritt gesehen. Man hat eine Wohnung bekommen, man hat sich satt essen können, man hat sich plötzlich Kleider kaufen können, man hat was verdient. Schon der Gedanke, dass nicht die Jahre... Das war eine gewisse Euphorie. Und in dieser Euphorie haben sie nicht mehr sich bewusst an alles erinnert. Das wollten sie gar nicht mehr, das vorher war. Dieses, was im Hintergrund geblieben ist, das ist natürlich im Hintergrund geblieben.
Das interessiert nicht mehr. Das ist vorbei. Wir haben es überstanden. Wir leben noch, Gott sei Dank. Und wollen darüber nicht mehr sprechen. Wir leben jetzt und jetzt für die Zukunft. Und wir sprechen eigentlich von dieser Zeit nicht viel. Das ist vorbei. Ich möchte eigentlich jetzt hier abbrechen. Ja. Recht ist, gell?
The appearance you might get was that there had never been any Nazis. Nobody had known anything. Nobody had done anything wrong, and they were all sort of innocently baffled by the whole thing. But when you started certain discussions in narrower circles where there was less fear of being pilloried for an utterance, there was a great deal of resentment of the injustice of the war. To them, this is a tremendous block of history where Germany was exploding like a nova, radiating across the globe, and that fascinates them.
Deutschland, überall, über alles in der Welt. Und dann kam sofort hinterher die nationalsozialistische Hymne, die hieß Die Fahne hoch, die Reihen dicht geschlossen. SA marschiert mit ruhig festem Schritt. Kameraden, die Rotfront und Reaktion erschossen, marschieren im Geist in unseren Reihen mit. Das mussten wir dann singen.
He's enjoying it.
Deutschland, Deutschland, über alles. Und jetzt auf einmal ging es so zur Hymne. Deutschland, Deutschland, über alles. Und bis alles gesungen war, musste man da stehen. Ob Frau, ob Mann, ob Greis oder Kind. Und wenn das Lied fertig war, dann hat man es so gemacht. Rührt euch.
that was happy reminiscence there, you can tell.
I've seen that in quite a lot of documentaries like this, where they're kind of, you know, they start getting fond, you know, just don't mention the war.
For the younger generation, those who had grown up in Germany in the years after the war, the past was completely mysterious. By the mid-60s, a growing number of them began to ask questions about this strange time, a period of history that neither their teachers nor their parents would discuss. Then, in 1968, came the student revolution, and an attempt began to uncover the truth about Germany's hidden past.
I think that in 68, with the student revolt, there was the memory knocking at the door. We were thinking at the generation which was not guilty in a very direct sense of this word, and we asked our parents and our grandfathers, what did you do all this time? Did you resist, or had you been a little Nazi, or had you been an opportunist? And this discussion was blocked by the elder generation, and so it became hostile. And so we were hunted and pushed through the streets by the police and by the people in this town.
Pause a second.
Germany's past.
That's a bit out of context. What do you mean you were hounded in the street? What are you talking about? You mean when you assaulted cops? When I think of, you know, especially 1968, I think of the New Left, right? Which is like, a lot of them were Maoists. I mean, you know, Stalin wasn't strong enough, right? Think of the Weather Underground and all that, lot, you know, and the Baader-Meinhof gang, who I think they mention in a minute. This is like as some of the most extreme leftists, you know, that there's ever been. When he says, like, we started asking our parents, what did you do in the war? Were you prompted to do that by your university professor and your sociology
professor? I'm getting the impression that guy was a commie.
Yeah, I reckon. He may well be one when he was a commie then, and then maybe like 70s and 80s he turned against it or something. Maybe, I don't know. Actually, the New Left thing, I don't know, people don't seem to go back on that as much as, you know, a lot of people who were Stalinists in the 30s went back on it very strongly and became cold warriors, right, for the West. But the New Left thing has not played out the same way. I don't think a lot of people are embarrassed about what they did in the 60s. Some are, but not.
No, they remain Maoist forever.
Yeah. And they find new ways of appearing moderate but being radical. That's how I think of Blair's government, right? Come across as like very sort of pro-business and stuff. Well, but it was new left thinking.
And not a lot of the new left got a little bit burnt in the late 70s and early 80s because they supported Pol Pot, right? Now, I'm not making this up now.
No.
And what they did was they cleverly reinvented themselves as human rights advocates.
Right.
So a lot of the language and the rhetoric went over to human rights. But they never stopped being Maoists. They just kind of tactically switch from openly supporting people like Pol Pot to, you know, talking the language of human rights.
That's the story of a lot of neocons, right? And I think of that, you made me think of Bernard-Henri Lévy for some reason, but he's just one example. You know, yeah, sort of very much into human rights and... came out of the New Left, ended up as a neocon warmonger, and it kind of works. It kind of fits. You know, there's quite a natural progression.
I mean, to name some names, I think Julie Kristeva did this, right? Kind of, feminist that a lot of people in university might read. She actually went over to Cambodia and wrote like a glowing review of Pol Pot's Cambodia. You know, she was given like the equivalent of the tour you might get of North Korea or something, you know? Came back and said, oh, Cambodia is great, actually. Then all the stuff came out about the Khmer Rouge, and people were like, hold on, Julia. And she was like, yeah, I'm all into human rights now. I'm all about the human rights. So
the problem with Pol Pot was that he didn't sufficiently respect human rights.
Exactly.
Became a central issue for the student movement. Many began to delve into recent history, and what they discovered astounded them. Not only had their teachers and their parents been involved with the Nazi Party, but many appeared to have taken part in crimes. There were terrible confrontations within families.
in die Jugend, die dann kommt, immer nur sieht, das wurde begangen und ist nicht dazugefügt worden, aber dein Großvater kann im Einzelnen gar nicht.
This reminds me, by the way, of the way that wokeified kids confront their parents now. Yeah. On, you know, I mean, you can see a kind of substitute version of it, the rebellion of Harry Potter and Hermione against J.K. Rowling for not being into the trans thing. But that happens in families across Europe and America, you know. Kids trying to police their parents, politically incorrect language and things like this. This is a kind of early version of it, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Dafür, dass mich die jungen Fragen, meine Neffen mit 22 und 26 Jahren, ja, wir werden mit der Schuldzuweisung unserer Großväter überhaupt nicht fertig.
Die ältere Generation hat sich davor gefürchtet, dass nun abgerechnet wird. Dass also jeder, wenn man erst mal anfängt bei einem, also sagt, der war bei der SS.
I mean, come on, Curtis. Student Movement 1968. Is he soft? Is Curtis soft covering for this dude? Because this guy was obviously a radical Marxist of some description.
Yeah, and Curtis is just removing it all from context. He's not saying what prompted this, right? Why didn't this happen 5 or 10 years earlier? And why was it not the same in 88, right? This is prompted by particular people, by activists.
These were French Marxist-inspired student activists. We're calling them Maoists. I actually know the direct kind of lineage they came from. You know, it's what Jordan Peterson would call the cultural Marxists. It's the kind of cultural turn in Marxism, is what we're talking about.
Frankfurt School got massive in the 60s.
Yeah, Frankfurt School, Louis Althusser, Michel Foucault,
Sartre,
you know, all of these guys. Yeah.
Wo war er, dass diejenigen, die neben ihm sitzen, gefragt werden, und wo waren sie und sie? Diese Angst, mit in deinen Sog rein zu geraten, hat natürlich eine Solidarität unter den Älteren geschaffen, über diese Zeit nicht zu reden.
Die haben uns nie gefragt, meine Neffen und Nichten, was habt ihr gelitten? Das ist es ja. Nach unseren Leiden ist nicht gefragt worden, sondern nur das, was wir nach außen hin gemacht haben. Das ist sehr erlebig von der Jugend, ja.
It was a complete confrontation. One part of this people against the other.
Ach, this.
The students were convinced that what they had uncovered was a hidden continuity with the Third Reich. Beneath the facade of a liberal democratic country, the fascist state had continued, run by the very same men and women who had administered Hitler's regime. A group emerged determined to expose this. They were led by Andreas Baader and Gudrun Enslin. Their aim was to resist fascism where their parents had failed. They were known as the Red Army Faction.
Dieser Staat hat, wie Sie es nannten, eine faschistische Fresse.
The Red Army Faction.
Their analysis is ridiculous. Like, of course there's a continuity between the old regime and the new. How could there not be? And also, like, even, you know, even if... I mean, there's like liberal democracy, as they call it, and fascism are not like different in every manner, you know.
Two different strains of managerial state in terms, yeah.
Right.
Die nur mit einer Maske verhüllt ist. Und sie haben, das war ihre Theorie, wenn man den verschleierten Faschismus zeigen will, muss man ihm nur die Maske vom Gesicht reißen. Und das geht nur, indem man sie angreift.
Pause a second.
The Red Army Faction embarked on a series of...
Go on.
This is also remarkably similar to, I think they were called Islamic Jihad, like Ayman al-Zawahiri's group before he met Osama bin Laden in Egypt. They convinced that it's in The Power of Nightmares that you come to in a couple of months, but their analysis was basically, we kill Anwar Sadat and then everyone will rise up. We rip off the mask of the Egyptian oligarchy or whatever. It's the same here. It's like, we just like sort of just show people that fascism's still in charge by terrorist attacks, by the way, and therefore everyone will realize, and then we'll have social justice.
I should mention that this was widespread across the West in 1968. It started in France, the May 68 riots in Paris. It was like everywhere. You know, they call it there's the summer of love and the summer of hate, right? And the 68 is where the kind of hippie dream started turning dark, because there were these violent student movements everywhere at that time. So it was an interesting thing.
People got bored of acid and started taking coke, and voila, everyone became an arsehole.
Bombings and shootouts with the police. Their strategy was to use violence to provoke the state into exposing its true identity. But as the violence escalated, some of the terrorist leaders began to have doubts. In trying to expose Germany's hidden past, they had unearthed something far more complex and far more sinister than they had bargained for.
I had begun to realize that fighting against the state by armed groups with this revolutionary strategy in mind was bringing up fascistic tendencies in the reaction not only of the political class, but in the people too. We ourselves became in the same way fascistic as the fascists were. We didn't realize that our enemies, our opponents, are human beings. This is what is in the heart fascism, the oppression of other meanings of the political opposition. And oppression means elimination by killing.
Was it frightening when you realized that that was happening?
Yeah, of course. Awfully frightening. This is one of the main...
I mean, they're calling it fascism. I would give a different name to it, which is simply politics. Because what they're stumbling on is friend-enemy pushed to its ultimate limit, right? Because the ultimate end of friend enemy is this, what they're talking about.
And they have to go to really crazy means to realize that, because they're so committed to not appreciating that, right? In the first place. And then they do realize it anyway.
Points in the development. The awareness that we are from the same stuff as the fascists were. We understood something. We understood that fascism is a component in all of us.
Do you think that's what we hid from ourselves at the end of the war?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We have a picture of ourselves. We want to be good. We want to be human creatures with the positive thinkings and so on, but we are a contradiction in ourselves, because we don't know to handle this contradiction. We don't have any means to live with this evil part in ourselves.
Horace, this guy has got a mental Wikipedia entry, which I have to read. Shall I read it?
Go.
Horst Mahler, who is the chap that we've been watching here, is a German former lawyer and political activist. He was once a far-left militant and a founding member of the Red Army faction, who later became a Maoist, before switching to neo-Nazism.
What?
Between 2000 and 2003, he was a member of the far-right National Democratic Party of Germany. Since 2003, he has been convicted of incitement of popular hatred and Holocaust denial, and he served much of a 12-year prison sentence.
I smell bacon. Do you smell bacon? I suspect some sort of glowing.
I have no idea.
Did he become some sort of stooge to discredit the MPD or something?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Really regretted being in the Red Army, actually?
Yeah, it says here he had a swing a swing to far-right politics?
Maybe. Maybe real, maybe at the behest of the intelligence services.
Do you know anyone who's done that?
No.
Switch the you know, go from a Maoist to, you know...
I was sympathetic to communism when I was about 16, 17.
I suppose it does happen. You do get people who go kind of... it's like what I call like the Keith Woods route or something, where, you know, you go from being a leftist or a tanky of some sort to
being a Wahhabist.
It'd like to end up somewhere around there. There's a kind of strange... Well,
Keith converted to Islam a few years ago as well, didn't he?
Did he?
Hadith al-Quds was his name for a while.
Did he?
No, and he wasn't really called Hadith al-Quds. That just sounds like Keith Woods a bit, you know. So
I have no idea. I don't
know. No, there was just suggestion because when he did a show with Richard Spencer and Ed Dutton for a few weeks, it sounded like they were sympathising with Islam or something, and a lot of the people started accusing them of having converted or something. It's just a joke.
I must have missed that.
But it's kind of a, I don't know, just sympathy with like Hezbollah or something like that. I'm not sure.
That would be the strangest trajectory of all if you ended up there.
Like when you think, I'm not really specifically talking about Keith here, I don't know if this refers to him, but like when you think of liberalism as the main enemy, you can end up in some strange places.
There is a. You see, I like you, Horace, have a libertarian background, and there's a kind of trajectory where you then start to realize some of the realities of politics, and then, you know, you realize a few other things, and so,
you turn into Jeffrey Cucker. But yeah, go on.
Yeah, I mean, and so you end up leaving many aspects of libertarianism behind. But you kind of also get a grounding in various, but there is another trajectory people have where they come from the left, they come from Marxism, and then start to realize, you know, who is this ruling class we're against, and so on. And, you know, I have seen people do that. So it's not out of the realms of possibility, but it's a very strange trajectory.
Moving to become a neo-Nazi in Germany in like 2000, that is weird. That is really strange.
But especially after you've driven your own father to suicide,
right?
Guilty, I mean, maybe you just see a psychological damage or something. I don't know, but.
In the autumn of 1977, the leaders of the Baader-Meinhof group committed suicide in jail. The attempt to change Germany by opening up its past was over. The threatening memories were reburied.
The memory is a swamp, like this building is built in a swamp, swampy area. So in a swamp, something comes up, makes a sound, a noise, boop. You smell something, and then once again the surface is clean and clear, and so this memory comes up sometimes, gives a noise, gives a bad smell, and then the surface is clean again.
But then, 10 years later, the course of European history suddenly changed. Communist domination of Eastern Europe collapsed.
Please show Hasselhoff.
Summer of 1990, Berlin celebrated the dismantling of the wall with a concert given by Pink Floyd.
Wrong. Roger Waters.
Fragments of the past came to the surface. In the no man's land between the two Berlins, a forgotten Nazi bunker was unearthed.
It was found by chance when here Pink Floyd has the great spectacle, The Wall, in the summer 90. And they telephoned me because I told them before one could find something. And that was the beginning of the battle for safeguarding this bunker.
And what did you find down there? Can you show us some of the things?
Yes, we there are some small objects, of course. So here's a bayonet. We only took some samples here. Silver spoon, it was from the official silver. These fragments, it was like a frozen moment of history 50 years ago. This frozen moment of apocalypse, the end of history, of a certain part of history.
It wasn't just fragments of the Nazi past that re-emerged. As the Cold War came to an end, a hidden history of Europe was awakened. Old rivalries and tensions, suppressed for 50 years, were rekindled. With them came the barbarism and the evil that the good war was supposed to have banished forever.
The infantry then went on a foot patrol to look for more casualties or evidence of atrocities. They didn't have far to search. They came upon a house in the center of the village where a family of seven had died, two in the stairway, another five in the cellar. It's hard to look at some of these pictures, harder to tell the story of Ahenichi without them.
What happened here can frankly not be shown in any detail, but the room is full of the charred remains of bodies, and they died in the greatest agony.
That's Martin Bell, who became an MP, isn't it?
Yeah, that, the man in the white suit.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine, in our continent and in our time, what kind of people could do this.
I just kept thinking that, there were people once. You know, I mean, this is Europe 1993, not 1943.
Sag mir, wo die Blumen sind. Wo sind sie geblieben?
I assume we're quite near the end. I'll save the rest of my comments for the end.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm assuming this happened in the former Bosnia, Yugoslavia, Bosnia. Yeah.
And I'm aware that we've gone sort of more than 2 hours, so I don't want to keep commenting on every bit. But...
All right, yeah. There's a little bit left, and then we'll finish and do the super chats quickly.
...to re-emerged in Europe are frightening, because they are linked to a time many thought had long been buried and forgotten. But history will not repeat itself. These forgotten pieces will be reassembled to tell a new story. They will be used to justify the new political ideas of the future. We are at zero hour once again.
Interesting, very interesting.
I think he kind of mangles it a bit, but overall it's great that he raises these things, these questions. Like, it's, you know, whether he brings the perfect answer or not, it's such important stuff to
look
at.
I mean, he's opening Pandora's box in a way, mm-hmm. to make a bit of a pun. But yeah, very interesting. And I hadn't seen some of that footage from the Nuremberg trials before either.
Yeah, it was a problem. The way Goering defended himself was a problem. They were really concerned by it. They had to adapt their approach and stuff.
Very interesting. But in a way, it's still very relevant, this, because I still don't think that the Europe and America or the world has still not yet dealt with the memory of World War II.
No.
And we're constantly living in its shadow. And I think one of the issues is that so much of the myth of World War II is built on these kind of shaky narratives that Curtis highlights, you know, their construction in this documentary. And it's not a kind of stable or lasting foundation for a society. And I think we're basically finding that out now, that it's kind of falling apart in a way.
This is like a permanent sort of derangement or mental illness imposed on us. I think most of us don't need to be taught that it's wrong to murder civilians, to start wars, to bully smaller countries, you know, to bully underdogs and stuff. And the people who impose the sort of what I would call the myth of the 40s and the 30s as well on us. It's as though they're preaching to us as though we are barbaric without their great influence. And it's just nonsense. Like, look at what they're doing to our countries. Like, it's become like a sort of a grotesque parody of itself. Like, if you were a soldier or a civilian in 1945 and you really believed that you just defeated a regime that killed millions of people and all this, then yeah, you're acting on good intentions. If I look at someone like Richard Evans, like the historian, or if I look at someone like, I don't know, who makes use of the war? If I think of Steven Spielberg, do I see a good person there? Do I think of someone who I'm learning moral lessons from? Not at all. I see people who are defending their own ideology or their own ethnic interests or their own profit, or just grinding us down psychologically out of hatred for us. So I agree with perhaps what the myth of the war ought to be. Don't be a bastard. But we've traveled so far down this just twisted, mangled ideological, psychological, sociological state, where it's become like the ideology of the evil people now.
I also think that a problem that they have, the regime, is that as long as they perpetuated these myths that we're talking about and they imposed them, they too end up becoming the thing that they're meant to hate. I know this sounds like a cliche,
yeah,
but they do all of the things that they're not meant to do. I'm not just talking about Israel right now, by the way. I'm talking about the actions of America and Britain since World War II. All of the wars they've started.
And the fact that, like, I think one really just mark of the horribleness of the regime we live under is that if, like, an old woman of 85, say, who lives in, say, Whitechapel, says that she doesn't like what's happened to her, I don't know if you know Whitechapel, it's like a Bangladeshi colony.
Oh, yeah, I live near there once, so never again.
Right, but there's still, like, the odd English person living in one house here and one house there, and, you know, a couple of people just stay there. Like, if they complain about what's happened around them in their immediate environment, they're just almost spat at, treated with contempt by people of 20 who all they know is what they've been taught by leftist teachers, right? That's a terrible outcome. It might seem like a small thing, but that's so wrong. That's so morally twisted that an old woman who's basically just been a modest and decent person all her life can be called, you know, a bigot, which is intended as a very strong insult, merely for a natural reaction to something that is genuinely unpleasant. That says a lot about the regime we live under, and also the fact that Antifa, people who are just thugs and criminals, can get away with going out and assaulting people and harassing venues and assaulting, you know, terrorizing people in general. The fact the regime obviously lets them do that unless they attack cops or whatever. That again, it's like you can pretend to be as nice as you want, but you're not. You're just not. You're bastards.
Yeah, it really is. That Sam Francis phrase, a narco tyranny, that is what they impose on the domestic level, but then on the international level, they literally do all the things. They break all of the rules that they're meant to stand for.
Yeah,
you know,
supporting Saudi Arabia. We're allied with Saudi Arabia.
It's just. I mean, it's just unreal.
We're like our strongest ally is Israel.
I don't know. There's no my contempt for the regime is. They probably peaked them quite a while back, and I've gone through all the stages of grief, and I just have what's the final one? Acceptance. I just kind of accept that this is what life is like under a terrible government. And all I have ever wanted is just to have a sensible government, a government that doesn't do these things and just does the basics. Maintain law and order. Don't get us into needless wars. Protect the border.
And I don't think either of us or any of us really demand that every tenet of our ideology is fulfilled. We all accept there's some need for compromise. But the people ruling over us don't. They don't compromise at all.
Oh, well, we can only... where's Bowden? Need to bring him out. I'm in the sort of mood. Where is he?
Clear them out.
Yeah, there he is.
Clear them out. Clear out. Clear them out. You've got to clear them out. You've got to clear them out as well. There needs to be a new start.
Brilliant.
All right.
My favourite other Bowden moment is just when he goes... Oh, we're sorry. We're not sorry!
yes. Let me hit some super chats here. Seamus O'Blaine says, Peterson was buck-broken in a Tel Aviv basement. I feel like his mental degeneration may have actually predated that.
So that commenter thought they were joking, but actually...
Crony says, have you ever realized Adam Curtis sounds a bit like Keir Starmer? I suppose so. I think Starmer's more bunged up, isn't he? He's more kind of nasal. I tell you what, I turned on in the car. I usually have my phone on and I'm listening to a podcast or something. But every once in a while, the Bluetooth thing goes and normie radio comes on and I'm stuck with it. Well, this happened one day and it was just a news broadcast and it was Keir Starmer giving a speech about his five-year plan. And I swear to God, I felt like I was in a bad production of George Orwell's 84. I really, 1984, because it was like, you know... we will bring peace and prosperity, when we enact my five pillars.
of Islam.
there's honestly something about Starmer that he's got the voice of a totalitarian bureaucrat. That's what he has.
Right.
O2 Tom says, views have skyrocketed since the hit piece. Not really. Not really. No real difference. There's no need to give any thought to anything like that. He says, live, Deepest Law, 2813, how World War II has written for the based world. Well, I don't know how many years that would take to get to 2000 and odd. Statius says, listen to the five-hour Judge Knapp stream and Unpopular Opinions today, now on Deepest Law, and I'm beginning to think that I hear AA narrate the thoughts in my head.
Yeah.
I did do a lot yesterday. Never again, though. I'm never doing 8 hours in a day again. I don't know how those EFAP guys do it. You know, people have like nine-hour streams and things. I have no idea how people do that.
Did you say EFAP?
There's this thing called EFAP where they have like 8-10-hour streams.
It's not what the fact bit is, not what I think, right?
It's just like people talking about movies and saying, you know, enough of the up yours, woke moralists. QWERTY7.
Sorry, I was just going to say, I once set myself to, because I like South Park, but I hadn't watched it for years. So I started thinking, oh, I'm going to watch all of them and catch up to season 50 or whatever it is. And after a few seasons of that, I just started literally dreaming in Cartman's voice. And it's like, no, you can't have that. You just got to stop. I've never watched it since. Horrible. Terrible.
QWERTY says, finally caught another live stream. When are you going to create an online college? I need to have more AA courses. Well, there is the academic agency there. It takes a lot of work to make a course, and I am not very good at doing things in chunks or bite-sized pieces or doing a little bit a day. I'm very much someone who does something all at once. I'm kind of total in that way, which means I need a lot of time and I need to be in a particular zone to do things. And so when I do get in that, I will do a Shakespeare course, I think. But I have to be in the right zone for it. Otherwise, it won't be very good. Aldo Banner says, I should do it. It'd probably make me loads of money. But, I just, I'm an artiste. You can't rush an artist. Aldor Banner says, do you do a deepest lore? Can you do a deepest lore on Yukio Mishima? Well, to my shame, I've never read any Mishima because I have a long-standing thing of not reading fiction. I've heard some good shows on him, though. Bap has got a couple of good ones in his back catalogue. So, you read any Mishima? I know he's highly thought of.
No, I've listened to Bowden's talk on him. That's about it. Oh, and I think Andrew Joyce did an article about it as well, but didn't encourage me to read it, to be honest.
P.S. says, Total War is based. Anything less is inevitably led by a feminine managed class you despise at the expense of those actually fighting. No, I disagree with that, P.S. Disavow.
Total War was led by managerial types.
Yeah, Total War is the outcome of feminine managerialism.
Yeah.
Most of the greatest generals in history didn't do Total War. I still haven't got around to making my defense of Genghis Khan video. But even the Mongols weren't as bad as you think they were when it comes to that.
Belisarius would have sniffed at the idea of Total War. Yeah.
Laws of Lycurgus. RIP Old World. Thank you, Gay, for your efforts. Now we can see what happens when business is above your people and culture. There's this game that I used to play called Reigns, where you play as a king. I don't know if you've played it. It's like you can play it on your phone or you can play it on your PC. And you're a king, and it's just got these cards. And there are these different scenarios that come, and you have to make decisions as a king, right? And there are these four factions in the game who need to be appeased. There's like the people, there's the merchants, there's the priests, and there's the military. Okay. So the four basic castes. And if any of the levels get too high or too low, it's a loss condition. It's a loss condition. So there are essentially eight conditions for you or loss. So if the military gets up to the top, for example, there's a coup because the general will be too powerful and you'll be killed. If the military gets to the bottom, you'll be invaded. You'll be invaded by an external force, right? And for the merchant one, if it gets too low, obviously you go bankrupt and you don't have any money, and you know, therefore you're overthrown. But if it gets too high, that is an end game outcome, and the merchants take over. And I often feel that we're living in the reality where the merchant bar hit the top, and we're living in that world where they overthrew everything. And you know, this is like what would happen if you lived in the end game of Reigns. Spasticus Autisticus says, Goering was also probably the least anti-Semitic Nazi leader. He protected Erad Milch, a half-Jewish Air Force marshal, from the Gestapo. I think he also protected Schmidt from the SS, as he collaborated with Jewish intellectuals.
Schmidt also went out with Hannah Arendt, didn't he? Although maybe that was after the war.
Probably.
She's Jewish.
I mean, I know that the person who was led a lot of the anti-Semitism in the Nazi party was Goebbels. He was the kind of one who really had that idea front and center in his thinking, more so than the others. From what I know, Himmler was the one who was a bit into the more kind of weird occulty elements. I'm trying to think of some of the others now. You know, they were a mixed bag. They didn't all have the same views.
But the typical thing, I think, sort of low level education is to just attribute everything Julius Streicher said in his newspaper. Just attribute that to like the whole Nazi party. Because I think some people have said he was an embarrassment even to the Nazis. You know, it was just so sort of crude and vulgar and hateful. You know.
Camelot Crusader says Keynesianism equals BS, therefore we get to print unlimited money for our friends.
Yeah.
Spasticus Autisticus says probably the worst of the post-war trials was the Yamashita trial. He was executed because some of the 250,000 men under his command committed crimes he couldn't have possibly known about and would have harshly punished had they been discovered.
Arguably, that's what happened to Slobodan Milosevic as well, that some people say that he didn't, you know, he didn't actually cause these crimes. Anyway, I don't know. I don't know about that, but some people say.
Rulam says, this is hard to entertain. The voice of this man cracks because I believe he realized in his elder years that he had caused the suicide of his father. The children were propagandized to shame the parents into silence and suicide. I mean, that fact alone could explain his later kind of a bad turn.
Yeah.
Because as you get older, you get more in touch with the idea of, like, of your lineage and your who your father is and all that sort of stuff as well, I think. Laws of Lycurgus says, does the modern hatred of Germany emerge from the Franco-Prussian War of 1870 to 1871? It feels like they've been blamed a lot for ever since that war. Well, it could explain the pathological anti-Germanophobia that was in the Anglo intelligentsia from that time onwards, because there's a lot of German hatred in, I mean, I've got this book by AJB Taylor somewhere where he just lays into the like German mindset and German culture and all sorts
That's
of things.
Right. Yeah. That was his point when he wrote The Origins of the Second World War, which some people took as like an exoneration of Hitler. It's not at all. But it's just saying that a certain version of history is kind of nonsense, that Hitler had this plan to set out conquering it. He says that's not true. But what he says is Hitler is just unremarkable by German standards, as in the guys who came before were trying to do much the same as Hitler as well. Mm-hmm. But Taylor himself was a sympathizer of the Soviets. And I mean, during the Cold War as well, he was like a diehard red, really. Mm-hmm. So he had no interest in exculpating Hitler, but he was just saying, no, you need to upgrade your hatred of Germany. So that it comes up to the same level as 1933 to 45.
UTIS 4321 says the individual doesn't exist. This is the supreme lie of liberalism. The laws of Lycurgus says at the time liberalism was competing with fascism. Matt Bell says Horus has floated in and out of my reactionary journey like an Indrian spirit guide. No particular forum. He just manifests from time to time.
I'm too much of an individual, you know. I don't attach.
I feel like there is a notion of the individual within fascism as well, though, because they wanted to. I remember watching this documentary once, talking about how German commanders were just given license to kind of do their own thing.
And the regional governors as well, the Gauleiters.
So there was actually quite a lot of individual autonomy given to people. You know, this notion, of like self-actualization and so on, and of heroism requires you to, you know, so there were like, I mean, everybody knows, who's that ace, that pilot ace from World War II?
From Richthofen.
Yeah, was it
the Baron? The Red Baron, yeah.
The Red Baron. I mean, they did have individuals in a way that, say, like in the Soviet bloc, was discouraged, right? So there is an individual, but he's kind of like a hero. He's valorized. He's, you know, held up as an example.
Soviets did that in a few cases as well, didn't they? With some of their snipers and stuff. There's this woman who they, commies of now, they post memes of this woman who shot, you know, 200 SS men or something. Whether she really did, probably not, right? But, you know,
yeah.
But they did it. And there was the sniper of Stalingrad. I can't remember what it's called. There's that house of, you know, it was like Pavlov's house, I think, in Stalingrad. You know, they liked their individual myths when it, you know, for war propaganda at least.
When
Stakhanovites as well.
When it suited them, yeah.
Yeah.
Laws of Lycurgus says, remember all this started with Winston Churchill. Matt Bell says, long live Miss Haverbeck. Spasticus Autisticus says, that guy whose dad committed self-Minecraft, Horst Mahler, founded the Red Army faction. I beg you to take a look at his Wikipedia page on air to see what he's done since. Yeah, I mean, he's gone to jail for Holocaust denial. So... Laws of Lycurgus says, I mean, it could be that he went down a rabbit hole, realized a couple of things that didn't quite add up, realized he'd killed his father and just went off the deep end.
Yeah.
You know, it's possible that's, you know.
Started read David Irving as well.
Yeah, you know, he could have gone down a particular path. Laws of Lycurgus says, I propose we start Winston Churchill Day, where we go over his illustrious career, and it should include a reading from Thomas Carlyle.
Are you doing a Winston Churchill Day?
I don't think I am going to do a Winston Churchill Day.
Like a marathon, sort of, like a telephone sort of thing, like calling with your thoughts about.
couldn't stand doing a whole day on that.
If anybody's interested, you could check out Iron Duke's channel, where he and I have done quite a bit of stuff about Winston Churchill.
Yeah, he's a friend of the channel, Iron Duke. I see him in chat sometimes. James D says, it feels like all Europe buried itself in a giant lie and a moral mindfuck, has been schizo and mentally ill since.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the problem is that when all of your myths are based on objective lies, which people know to be lies, I'm not saying anything in particular, I'm saying like there are things in the World War II myth that are objectively just not true.
Mm.
You know, verifiably not true. Like, for example, you know, how many times did the Germans try to have peace? 20, 25, something ridiculous. They sued for peace and it was rejected every single time. You know, stuff like that. It's just like, it's a matter of record. And yet the version in people's heads is, you know, the complete opposite. So Anglo Eddie says, hello, gents. Are you both looking forward to David Irving's third volume of Churchill's War? I have to admit, I have never read any David Irving. I don't really read kind of big history books like that very often. I did buy all these big civilization spanning books a while back because I kind of like grand history. I tend not to read books on like really specific things, like, you know, just this war or just this regime or whatever. But have you read any?
I've read a few of his books. I have only read part of volume one of Churchill's War so far, so I've still got two. I happened to look at his website today, and I only saw that the third volume was going to be released, because I thought after he'd done his Himmler book a couple of years ago, I saw him speaking in London, just at a little place, and he was really frail and quiet, and I thought, you know, sadly, I thought this guy is going to die soon.
Well, there were rumours that he had died.
And there were rumours a few months ago that he died, and then he's fine. And he's actually putting out another book. Like, I just want to give a massive thumbs up to the guy. Like, good on you. You're still putting out books. I mean, brilliant. Well done.
Stumbling says, thanks for an excellent stream. Is the West actually dying, or is the Boomer Truth regime dying, or harming the West in the process? Will Western kind experience a revival after the Day of the Pillow?
The Day of the Pillow, that's horrible.
Yeah, I mean, that was coined by Vox Day, that expression. The day.
A million quibbles with the Boomers, but still, I really don't like that.
I would say that it is inevitable that some sort of comeback will happen. Question is when. I feel like the actual state itself, in Britain's case, is beyond saving at this point, and that it may require a kind of shift in mindset among European peoples to think in a different way, in order to quote unquote, you know, save Western kind. It may require thinking more like a diaspora, or you know, something like that, than thinking in terms of can you save Parliament or something like this, because they seem totally gone, and I don't see any prospects for actual revolution anytime soon. So
there's one prospect that could bring about something better that I see, but it's quite horrible in itself. It's just a sudden, but this time the real big one they can't deal with, financial panic, which I suspect may happen by the end of this decade. And I'm talking, you know, they cannot sort it out this time. You can't just QE it again. It's insoluble, and there'll be then, this is what Gavin Bowlby argues, a sudden contraction. I mean, this is my term, but a sudden contraction of the state, where suddenly people are just not getting streetlights, not getting A&E, not getting, there's not food in the shops, and so on and so on. Right? And it's that suddenly then people get very, very realistic, and they got no time for illusions then, you know. If that happens, all possibilities are back on the table then.
That is true. That is true. P.S. says, total war equals Lion regime. Anything less is Fox regime. No, I don't agree with that. I just don't agree, I'm afraid. Just not the case. And in fact, total war has been the doctrine of America, the ultimate Fox regime, yeah. and of Britain, which has been a Fox regime. So it's just a lie, P.S., I'm afraid. Just a lie. And Stumbling said, oh, we did that one. And that's it, I think. That is it. So thank you. We went a bit longer than I was expecting, but it was an interesting show, I think. A lot to get into today. So,
I think so.
Yeah.
Oh, may I plug my thing again?
Yeah, where can people find you?
Go to eternalhorus.substack.com. And if you subscribe, you will soon get a new essay in your inbox. It's coming out soon.
And I'll just remind people, do buy my courses, 25% off, promo code MELLOW. Like and subscribe, join the channel. But most importantly of all, ladies and gentlemen, get out.
We're going on in this town, isn't it, human?
As long as I'm living here, it is.
So maybe you should have been living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.